Okay, well, welcome, everyone. This is the Critique Seminar Conference on Underlying Causes of the Crisis in the Economy. I'm Susie Wiseman. We have four panelists in this first session, and the first session will go until 2:30. Then we'll break for I don't know how long, then we'll come back. But the idea, as you probably know, is to have a lot of discussion. So I'm going to try to limit the speakers. First, the idea is to limit them to 15 minutes to start, but hopefully they'll stick to it. and then we'll wait for the first round of discussion till after everyone finishes, and then we'll move on to probably an hour of discussion. Then we'll break, come back, and then do the same thing later on. And before I introduce the panel, well, I can do it. Jack Rasmus, Michael Hudson, Hillel Tikton. We're waiting for Mitt Cox to show up. We have a good mix, two Brits, two Americans. It's where the crisis is the most profound, I guess, and generalized and increasingly globalized. And we're in, of course, you probably know, new territory. Is the traditional fixes don't work. Interest rates are effectively zero in the United States and doesn't seem to help the long-term weaknesses of the advanced economies. The bubbles have deflated and the model has imploded. That's the model of the bubbles. And so we are looking today at the profound and unresolved underlying problems which have been papered over in the real economy by debt in the last period. And now, of course, as you all know, and as you're all feeling, especially in the United States, the financial sector's in meltdown. We're in the midst of an insolvency crisis, and it's, of course, the most devastating since the Second World, since the Great Depression. In the United States, unemployment is skyrocketing. Jack, I'm assuming, is going to talk about that at an unprecedented rate. Yesterday, they announced that there are 4.8 million on unemployment insurance in the United States. That's the highest number since 1967. And, of course, in the U.S., the government needs to nationalize the banks and or take them over because the system is completely dysfunctional. But to do so means using the N-word. And the N-word, of course, this time is nationalization. See, you can't even use it here. that all the tinkering, all of the financial tinkering that they've done in the past with interest rates just can't work and does not work. So we're going to look at why, and also look at why the responses are wrong. And as you probably know, they're meeting in Davos as we speak, and yesterday Arianna Huffington reported that if the bankers and the politicians were stocks, people in Davos would be shorting them. And Michael Hudson, I'm assuming, I read his Counterpunch piece yesterday. He says that the responses so far are irresponsible and unethical. It's a transfer of wealth upwards to the greedy and criminal bankers and investors by the party of wealth. And, of course, he's making note of the fact that after all the so-called bipartisanship of Obama, all of the Republicans, without right down the line, voted against the stimulus package that was proposed. Hillel, I believe, will be saying that it's a turning point in world history because the basis of the equilibrium of the world system has been dealt a major blow and that capitalism has become permanently unstable. Jack Rasmus here will predict, I believe, he's predicting already 20 million unemployed in the United States by year's end and is calling this an epic recession. And he has a 12-point fix? 8-point, how many?
20.
20-point fix every time it's growing. It's going to be the 20-step program. And Mitt Cox, I assume, is going to be speaking about the globalized response and international relations. And then the question, of course, I should just quote, too, because the fixes are, of course, a problem. They involve, they face the obstacles of scale, of will, of politics, and of ideology. The scale, $850 billion, has been proposed in the United States, up to $2 trillion. That's not enough. And the crisis is global unless there's some sort of globalized response. It's probably not going to work. The Levy Institute in the United States, which is a Keynesian institute, has said The prospects for the U.S. economy have become uniquely dreadful, if not frightening. That's their quote. They said that you need to spend 10% of GDP, it's a minimum of $2 trillion, to reverse the economic contraction. Obama's proposing 3%, just to give you a notion of the scale. And, of course, it needs to be global. It does no good if GM creates jobs in China making automobiles but does nothing in Detroit, and that could happen. So that's the other part of it. So the question is whether or not any of this will work, and we're already beginning to see responses. Are the French workers leading the way? Especially in the United States, we always look to France and the workers there with their strike 2 days ago, or the Greek youth with their anti-capitalist revolt. And what are the scenarios? I'm hoping that all of our panelists will look at that today. Social democratic scenarios, anarchist scenarios, nihilist scenarios. In the United States, the left is pretty much absent. Labor movement's greatly weakened. Socialism is discussed, but in a crude manner, and it's not on the agenda. So that's what I'm hoping that we're going to look at. Now, finally, just because I've spoken too long, our panelists, Jack Rasmus teaches politics and economics at St. Mary's College and Santa Clara University. His forthcoming book is called Epic Recession and Global Financial Crisis. He has several previous books, Political Economy of Wage and Price Controls and The War at Home. And he writes widely. You can read his pieces in Critique and Against the Current. He's a playwright, former president and vice president of various local unions. Michael Hudson, right here, president of the Institute of the Study for Long-Term Economic Trends. He's a distinguished research professor of economics at the University of Missouri in Kansas City and the author of Superimperialism, the Economic Strategy of American Empire. And he was the chief economic advisor to Representative Dennis Kucinich. Michael Cox, not yet here. And so I'll introduce him.
He's
on his way?
He said he's here.
Okay, so he is a professor of international relations at the LSE. He's the co-director of the Cold War Studies Center and teaches on the TRIUM Global Executive MBA program, which is an alliance of NYU Stern, LSE, and the HEC School of Management. Writes on international politics, the Cold War, U.S. foreign policy, and the behavior of superpowers, and he's the editor of Rethinking World Politics. He's also one of the editors of Critique. He's got a whole slew of books you can Google and find out what they are. Hillel Tikhtin last. Everybody here knows Hillel. He's the editor of Critique and emeritus professor of Marxist studies at Glasgow University. It was a big struggle to get Marxist studies going. And author of dozens, if not hundreds, of articles on political economy, on the USSR, the FSU, South Africa, finance capital, and the nature of capitalist decline. He's also the author of Origins of the Crisis in the USSR, the political economy of South African capitalism, the politics of race and discrimination in South Africa, ideas of Leon Trotsky, and other books as well. Okay, that's enough. We are going to begin with Jack Rasmus, and he's going to be speaking about Epic Recession.
Well, there's no lack of descriptive, narrative, superficial, empirical analyses of what's been happening with the financial crisis. You can pick up any press, business press, Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, whatever, and you can read day to day what's happening with these different financial institutions and so forth. But there's very little on, from what I've seen so far, on any kind of fundamental analysis of what's really driving the whole thing, what's underlying it. So let me start with some questions. Why has the current financial crisis been so virulent, spread so fast and so deep, so quickly and so to the depth that it has, and precipitated now in the last several months an equally extraordinary decline, rapid and deep, in the non-financial economy? Why has traditional monetary policy failed to stabilize the crisis after more than $3 trillion in U.S. alone of liquidity injected into the system? In fact, the more they inject, the more it appears to become more unstable. Will it continue to fail to stabilize the system? despite zero interest rates, quantitative easing, bad asset aggregator banks, which are coming here next week, $2 trillion more, which I predict they'll probably have to pump into the system of liquidity, and the bubble in the long-term treasuries, which is now building. Why is the current real economy collapse best described as an epic recession, a term that I've sort of coined, which means something more than a normal recession but not yet a depression, characteristics of both normal recessions and depressions, an unstable hybrid condition that cannot be maintained at its current epic stage, must either be contained and return to a more stable recessionary perspective, or it will evolve to a true global depression. Will fiscal policy, in particular what we're seeing evolving now with the Obama program, $825 billion, will that also fail to stabilize the situation? Is it too, like monetary policy, too little, too late? Apart from the ethical question of, yes, of course, they're stealing from the taxpayer and the working middle class and giving it to the investor class, whatever you want to call it, that's going on. But apart from the ethical question, which is obvious, you know, will it succeed or will it fail? Is it enough? I think it's far less than is going to be necessary, even far less than the folks at Perry are predicting. If we look at the Great Depression in the 1930s, during the New Deal period, middle of the 30s, GDP, government share of GDP had risen to about 20%, which is about what it has been in the post-war period. You didn't get a resolution of the crisis in the 1930s until you had government spending in 1942 reach a minimum of 40% of GDP, and by 44 it was up to 70% of GDP. That means government spending is going to have to increase from its roughly $3 trillion to $6 trillion, which means they're going to have to inject at least $3 trillion more. My 20-point program that I sent to the House Finance Committee in the U.S., does require $3 trillion in order to stabilize this, and I'll talk more about that later if we have time. And finally, you know, are we at a historic economic juncture here? Has the solutions and the strategy that was put in place following the stagnation of the 1970s, which has bought the capitalist system three decades of further survival, now looks like it's pretty much played out? Yes, it generated a recovery for them in terms of profits. It allowed them to stabilize a seriously stagnating system in the 1970s. But now we see it created its own fragility along the way, created its own contradictions, particularly in the financial sector, but also in the real sector as well, as they transferred trillions of dollars of income from the working and middle classes and pretty much stagnated 90 million households that we would say 80,000 below, which is pretty much the middle class, pretty much congruent with the 110 million non-supervisory production and service employees in the United States. Has this restructuring run out? What's going to replace it? Does it look like they have anything fundamental in mind at the moment, or are they kind of stumbling, feeling their way to come up with a new restructuring, which I call the fifth restructuring? If you look at American capital, every several decades it does a major restructuring. It went through that in the right before World War I in preparation for a role on the world stage. The income tax, the Federal Reserve System was created, and so forth. There was a defensive restructuring during the 1930s, the NIRA and the New Deal, which was repealed before the end of that decade. It was the major restructuring after World War II, Bretton Woods, and a whole new arrangement with labor, symbolizing the Taft-Hartley Act, a whole new post-war retirement and health care and benefits system, and a number of other developments, which served to satisfy the growth of the system until the 70s when the stagnation came again. And then the fourth restructuring was really the whole Reagan period, started under Carter, and a whole number of initiatives, policy initiatives, which are in my book, The Evolution of Those Initiatives, the book War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Ronald Reagan to George W. Bush, from 1980 to 2004. And now, of course, we're at another juncture, I believe. And can capital come up with a whole new way of extracting surplus, if you want to put it in Marxist terms, and maintaining profitability with a whole new way of whole new set of forms of how to maintain exploitation? And in the process, I believe, we'll have to create a new kind of banking system, and probably will result in a more significant role of the state in maintaining the profit system than ever before. I'm going to skip the whole picture of, I'm going to presume you know, the fun of the narrative, the empirical stuff about how the crisis emerged in the U.S., the construction, residential housing and commercial property boom, $4 trillion in 4 years in new mortgages. Looks like about half of those now are toxic subprimes. And, of course, the toxicity is expanding now to Alt-A's and prime loans and commercial property and so forth. It's not a subprime crisis. It's a general crisis of speculation, as I will explain that. And, you know, what happened from the subprime bust appearing in July, August of 2007, the Federal Reserve and the Treasury do essentially nothing until the end of the year, and then the banks start freezing up loaning to each other, the interbank market dries up, asset-backed commercial paper dries up, other markets begin, short-term credit markets begin to dry up. The Fed and the Treasury make some tentative weak moves. The first auction is established, in a Fed auction in December. It has no effect. The crisis deepens in the first part of 2008. Other markets begin to go under. You finally get the speculators playing the downside of the investment banks, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, the bailout of Bear Stearns. The CEOs of the banks trot out in April saying the crisis is over. We got a recovery. Of course, just the opposite. The crisis is deepening. None of those guys will be around in 6 months. And the crisis reaches a second stage, I believe, with the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac bailout, where it becomes clear that the government has to nationalize the GSEs. It does so, and it leaves the stockholders, common stockholders, on the shelf. In other words, it protects the bondholders, particularly the foreign bondholders, sends a signal to all the other short sellers and speculators, who then start driving down the price of all the other investment banks in September immediately. And that provokes the need for the government to step in even more. And we got the banking panic of 2008 off and running in September. That follows with the TARP program. And what you get with the TARP program is $700 billion and a forced merger of some of the other banks. But TARP represents the solution to buy up the bad assets, as they say. But Paulson doesn't buy up the bad assets. Why doesn't he buy up the bad assets? Because there's no market for them, and they don't know what price. And the bankers will not sell at the low market price. They'd rather sit on those assets, even though they've dropped 90% in value or whatever, than sell those assets. So Paulson faces the dilemma of paying above market price and incurring the wrath of Congress, or selling at the, or not being able to sell at the low price. What you got is a banker strike. And we've had a banker strike going on ever since then. And I've already talked 10 minutes. Okay. Okay, so that's the banking panic. By the end of 2008, what do we got? We got almost $3 trillion of liquidity injection into the system. It's a solvency crisis, not a liquidity crisis. They keep throwing more and more money into the hole. Bank balance sheets continue to open up because they're not addressing the fundamental problem of the whole situation, and that is falling asset prices, particularly housing asset prices. But now we've got all kind of asset prices collapsing along the board. And rather addressing that fundamental problem, they're addressing the temporary solution, which represents the banking lobby's, you know, power in the whole situation. And the asset prices continue to fall. By the end of 2008, asset price deflation is spilling over into product price deflation and labor market deflation. Deflation is becoming generalized. It's beginning to provoke a collapse of the consumption and at the same time a collapse of business investment, which results now in emerging defaults, which is going to be the story of 2009. Standard Standard & Poor's and Moody's are predicting a 10-15% default rate. A lot of these companies that were kept afloat with junk bonds and all kinds of provisions are going to go under. And the defaults are going to feed back upon the system. And we're going to see a second round of, I believe, a banking crisis late this year or early next year, which is just exactly what happened during the Great Depression. We had a series of four banking crises in between, feeding back on the non-bank system, causing defaults, feeding then back on the banking system. This is like 1930-31. Folks at that time didn't think they were in a depression. They thought they were in a serious recession. It didn't look as bad as 1920-21. They thought they'd get out of the whole thing. But, of course, the defaults then provoked another series of banking crises, which drove the real economy down. And they're feeding off of each other. And the whole thing behind the whole story here is the excess debt. If you look at total debt, government debt, consumer debt, and corporate debt, in 1980, less than $4 trillion, according to Federal Reserve flow of funds. Today, it's $49 trillion. $22 trillion in debt alone since 2000. Okay? Most of this is corporate debt. There's only one trillion new consumer debt, and that's because workers' incomes can't keep up and they're using debt to try to stabilize their standard of living. Government debt, $3 trillion. $18 trillion is corporate debt, pretty much evenly spread between non-financial and financial debt. The corporate debt, the unwinding of that debt, is the financial crisis. It's the other side. How do we get all that debt is the key question. You get all that debt because of speculation. Finance capital has changed in a number of fundamental ways. It's become more speculative in terms of its investment. And it's the whole relative mix of speculative investment, particularly speculative financial investment, to total investment has shifted over the years. And it's not a question of financialization. I don't buy that term, financialization. It's kind of, to me, like globalization. It's more ideology than not. It's not as if the financial companies, banks, are so immense that they're you know, crowding everybody out and taking over. It's not the Hilferding thesis. I don't believe that. We got finance companies that are global manufacturing companies, and it's all quite mixed today. But speculation is a general norm. And at the heart of speculation, the new speculation, is the last 10 years in the whole process of securitization. Securitization is when it's based on derivatives. You take a real asset, you chop it up, you throw it in a financial salad bowl, you throw other pieces, asset-backed commercial paper, auto loans, student loans, credit card loans. You mark it up, you sell it, someone else takes it, marks it up, they sell it. Immensely profitable, no cost of goods, no cost of sales. You can make 20-30% profitability. And if you've shifted income over the years, in the last 30 years, you've put a lot of income in the hands of the investor class. The most wealthy 1% households, for example, in the U.S., in 1978 had 8% of the income, total income, disposable income. In 2006, they had 22%, which is just about what it was in 1929. So we have this speculative boom that's gone on, that's driven all this debt, and the nature of speculation, of course, is short-term interest, a short-term betting on price changes up and down. And the speculations have gone to an extreme where, you know, you got bets on the bets. And that's what derivatives and credit default swaps are all about. They're betting on the betting. There's several times, multiple times, the amount of CDS contracts exist on the number of bonds that actually exist. Someone's going to lose and someone's going to pay off big when you start having these corporate defaults. So you get a picture of debt causing deflation as it unwinds, causing defaults, spreading to the real economy, causing contractions in an epic way in the real economy. If you just look at what's happened in the last few months, if you calculate unemployment correctly, which the government doesn't, there are 1 million jobs lost in November, 1 million jobs lost in December, and I predict another million here. You gave a figure of 4.8 million. Those are only people collecting insurance. You know, there's another official 6 million who aren't collecting unemployment insurance. And if you add the underemployed, who are being created at even a greater rate than the unemployed, you know, we've had 4 million people who have been shifted from full-time to part-time work. Well, the government doesn't count a part-time person as unemployed. Then you got discouraged and those willing to work and so forth. There are about 13 to 14 million people in the United States without jobs. And all the economic indicators show that we're going to have another 5 to 7 million without jobs. We could have 20 million people without jobs. Now, Obama's program calls for $825 billion, $275 billion concession to Republicans and so forth on tax cuts, which will have absolutely no effect on the economy, $550 billion in spending to create at $137,000 a job, too expensive, over 18 months, 3 million jobs. 3 million jobs, we're going to have 20 million unemployed. You're going to see a second stimulus program that's going to have to emerge and will emerge, because this one's not going to do it. It's simply not enough, quick enough. The composition of it, as well as the magnitude of it, a lot of long-term jobs, job creation, alternative energy, and environmental stuff and public works. You could have a shortage in the construction industry, employment shortage, and millions of people still unemployed, which is what's going to happen. So it's not going to really have a sufficient effect, I don't believe. We're going to have to have a second stimulus. Which leads us to the whole question that I started out with, and that is the problem that they face right now of sort of trying to deal with the immediate crisis and trying to put something else in place long term, more stable. And I think they're going to have a significant problem in doing that because the fundamentals of stopping the asset price collapse now spreading into product prices and wages is not going to prove sufficient at this point. I didn't have time to really talk about speculation in my whole thesis of this in great detail, and we'll be glad to do and explain that more in the question and answer. But basically my thesis is that there's a growing relative weight mix of speculative finance and speculative investment forms in the total investment mix. And this is spreading, throughout the investment community, and is crowding out other forms of real investment long term, and is diverting real investment long term into speculative, more profitable forms, and is driving capital from the financial centers, real capital, physical capital, to the periphery of the system, and it's creating a greater reliance on credit rather than money. And that's why they can't control it with the money supply. They throw $3 trillion of liquidity into the system. It's not a liquidity crisis. It's a solvency crisis. But throwing liquidity at it only delays the resolution of the problem because it doesn't fundamentally deal with the problem. And we've got a long-term implications are long-term economic growth and cyclical instability and long-term profitability trends slow down and so forth. Okay. And they told me I had 20 minutes, not 15. So
well, you took 20. Are you done?
I did. Okay.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Jack Rasmus. Next, Michael Hudson. And as I said earlier, Michael, author of Super Imperialism, president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends. Michael, take it away.
Okay, now for a change of pace. When Hillel and Susie asked me to talk, I thought the topic was going to be a structural change of capitalism. There is a structural change, and it is financial, and I'm going to give you an example. Under the old way of making money, under industrial capitalism, firms would hire workers to produce goods, they'd sell the goods at a markup, and that was their profit. The idea was that the system was supposed to grow and the profits were going to be reinvested in new tangible capital formation. That's not happening. What you're happening is a new way of making money off labor, and it's what Pinochet called labor capitalism, which means labor is how you make money off of, not for labor. That was the use of Thatcher and in America, and the idea is for forcible wage withholding of salaries up to about 10 to 15%. Money withheld is put into a pension fund. This is called pension fund socialism, which is about as socialistic as socializing the banks by giving them $8 trillion. the management fee of 3% absorbs the entire revenue from that is made by the worker savings. So you have the largest influx into the capital markets since 1980 have been the pension funds. The stock market volume has actually been shrinking. There's been a disinvestment from the stock market as the bondholders are borrowing money, taking companies private, and extracting interest, turning what used to be profits under the old system into interest payments. So now that the amount of stocks outstanding is shrinking, who's buying them? The pension funds are buying the stocks from the managers with exercising their stock options and from the venture capitalists that have put money into the IPOs. So essentially the money withheld from labor's paychecks is going to create capital gains for the managers to bid up the stock market, and if Bush would have had his way, privatization of Social Security would have added $2 trillion almost immediately into the stock market to help create a big stock market boom. Bush almost got away with it, but the dot-com bubble burst and people suddenly discovered, wait a minute, prices can go down as well as go up. We don't want to take a risk on Social Security. So what's happening is that essentially not only is the exploitation of workers taking the form of managing their savings, and as long as the money managers at the 2% or even 1% management fee get all of the income, then the workers are left either with the capital loss or the capital gain, or as it turns out, the loss. So worker savings have lost an average of 40% just in the last year. All this money that they've set aside. Imagine if this would have been Social Security. Now, Susie at the beginning talked about nationalizing the banks. It's much. I think it's easier to say that the banks have privatized the government. And not only are they doing it through lobbying and through the control, they're not privatizing Dennis Kucinich. I've done my best. I've tried to be privatized, and they're very selective as to who they're privatizing, I'm sorry to say. what's happening now is there's a new kind of privatization in America. What you've seen under Thatcher is the dress rehearsal for what we're seeing in the United States. And the crisis there is in state and local finance. In 1930, states and localities in the United States got 70% of their revenue from the real estate tax. Today, only 15% of state and local revenues come from the property tax. Most of this is the result of lobbying by the real estate sector, but more by the banks, because what the banks realize is that what the tax collector gives up creates a surplus of rental value that is able to be pledged to the banks as interest. So the populist rhetoric that's coined by the banks and the real estate people is now you're really being squeezed by taxes. What's causing the crisis today is real estate. All you have to do is give us tax relief. And because appraisals for property are usually about 3 to 5 years behind, right now the states and municipalities are still going up for property. And the banks say, if you're going to collect taxes on this, then either you're going to force defaults by the homeowners, or else you're going to just squeeze these poor retirees who have the homes. So essentially, the poor homeowners and the subprime borrowers are now being trotted out like widows and orphans are. If you tax wealth, you're going to tax somebody who only makes $10,000 a year and he can't afford to pay the tax. Pity him. Lower the taxes, especially in the upper brackets, because we create the wealth. Because we create the asset price inflation, and the asset price inflation is what's enabled consumers to go into debt to buy all of these goods that has kept the whole economy alive during the bubble. So there's an imagination that what you've been experiencing for the last years as wonderful prosperity has somehow been interrupted. They don't see the bubble as interrupting what was the whole expansion of industrial capitalism that was supposed to expand. So you have finance capitalism as an extractive, parasitic phenomenon. And the idea of parasitism is misused. You think of it as a parasite as someone just extracting nourishment from the host, but it's much more complex in nature, and biology is ahead of the economists here. The first thing a parasite does is take over the brain. It takes over the brain of the host to make it think it's actually part of the host. Indeed, the host's baby, to be nurtured and protected just as it would protect a baby. Every kind of parasite in nature does this. So the host gets confused until finally it gets sort of old, and the parasite then lays the eggs in the host and gets the host eaten by somebody. In this case, the host is the financial, the host is being eaten by the government, and that's what I meant by privatizing the government. This is a phase change. This is something new. And if you look at the recent solutions to the Obama administration, I sort of hesitate to call it the Obama administration. I think it's really, at first I thought I should call it Bush 3, because he's kept on all the Bush people. But then I think maybe it's Clinton 5, because it all began under Clinton. But it really is Reagan 8. It's a continuation. It's a continuation of the whole trend that they brought in Mr. Greenspan to sort of administer as the Mr. Chuckles, talking it all up with the Ayn Rand rhetoric of how you'll all get rich as soon as you give us your money. So I can see why some people don't want to call it asset, just financialization, because a lot of it is based on real estate. I prefer to think of it as neo-feudalism, because what you're having is what the states now are actually being forced to lower the real estate, the property tax, even more, because otherwise the banks would have to foreclose and you'd have property going down. And what they're doing is selling off the roads, the public enterprises, the public land, essentially to private buyers. Especially they're looking for foreign buyers. And the idea is the same kind of stuff that you were told in London, that the private sector can do it better. And it can do it better because it adds on interest charges, management charges, takes the capital gains. The interest, by the way, because they're all financed with borrowed funds, the interest is tax-exempt, so the tax receipts go way down. So essentially they're creating a tax-exempt, a privatized sector that really is run as a financial vehicle to get profits and capital gains. But of course, most capital gains, when you talk about capital, they're really property price gains. They're asset prices. And the largest asset in every economy is the land. And that's what not many people are talking about right now. Most of the bubble, as you know, was all on land price gains that were inflated by credit. And as you're having the crisis now, the financial sector comes in with its way of making money, which, as I said, does not involve employing labor and squeezing and exploiting it. I remember in 1996, I had to give, we used to call it the Leon Trotsky Memorial Speech before the Duma, and I was able to go there once a year and give a speech to the Duma, and I said, I have good news and bad news. The good news is the American capitalists are not coming to exploit your labor. They're not going to they don't want your labor. What they want is your land and your resources and your minerals. So it's not the typical kind of it's not what they would have learned in Marxism. And unfortunately, I found that none of the Russian officials that I talked to in the mid 90s had read Marx, and I tried to tell them that's it. And they said, "Well, what do you read in America?" And I said, "Well, every leading analyst in Wall Street learned how capitalism works by reading Capital. If you don't know it's all about exploitation, how are you going to read a balance sheet?" they just shook their heads, missed it. But here's the plan that they have for America to save it. The banks say, we're going to once the prices go down more, that land prices have to fall by another 30%. There are expected to be 10 million foreclosures next year on American families. Already, one quarter of all U.S. real estate is negative equity. That is, the mortgage exceeds the price of the land. So the banks are going to come in and say, we have a wonderful thing to do. We're going to, the government will buy out all of our mortgages at the face value. It will absorb the loss. It will then renegotiate the mortgages to current market price with the occupants or the mortgagee, And it's going to form a corporation with the financial companies. And the corporation is not only going to get interest of probably about 6%, which is larger it can get anywhere else, but it's going to get what in the 1980s the SNL, Savings and Loan Associations, asked for, and that's an equity kicker. The idea is that in exchange for the current mortgagee having the mortgage written down to the mortgage value, he will... Oh, not only the interest, but the lender will get the capital gain. Now they can come in and reinflate land prices, and instead of the families, the mortgagee, getting the value of the land prices that goes up, the creditor will now get it. That's called sharing in the gains. And the plan then is to create a new land bubble by inflating, and on terms where the creditors will get the capital gain, not the borrowers. Now, I should say that almost all of the American families, the Federal Reserve publishes every 3 years a survey of consumer finances, and it shows that almost all of the wealth of the middle class in America has come from the rising price of its house. People believe that they've been getting richer and richer as the price of their house goes up. That's all they sort of talk about at parties for the last 10 years. Not the political parties, but other kinds of parties. And they feel that they're getting richer and richer when the price goes up faster than the debt. But now the prices have gone down, leaving the debts in place, and all of a sudden they realize that what they thought was getting rich off the house has just let them saddled with debt. In the bailout, the U.S. Government has taken over $8 trillion of debt over the last 3 months. In the next 2 months, there will be $2 trillion more. Now, to give you an idea of magnitude, President Bush said 8 years ago, that over the next 50 years, the Social Security system was going to run a $1 trillion deficit. He said, we can't afford it. You have to get rid of it. He then spent $3 trillion on the Iraq War, $8 trillion in 3 months to finance, and finance says, now that we've just given ourselves $8 trillion and another two, there's really no money for Social Security and health care. Fortunately, we have the solution to the healthcare and medical problem is being cured by the fact that, as you were just told by the previous speaker, there will be 20 million unemployed. Thank God when you're not employed, you lose all of your medical insurance and nobody's going to have to pay for them. So that's curing the Medicaid financial crisis, partly. I calculated what we need for the equilibrium, and he talked about equilibrium. There is an equilibrium for the United States. Wages will have to go down by 25%. The death rate will have to shorten by about 20 years, as it did in Russia. And Mr. Summers was excellent in this. He designed, essentially, the Russian stabilization program. Death rate goes up. Alcoholism goes up. Drug abuse goes up. The problem solved. So I'm not sure when they say it's a crisis. Certainly the crisis has opened a way for putting the class war back in business, and at least one class has a political program about how to solve it and how to come out of it.
Oh, very good. Thank you. Talk about discipline. You did it. So that was very good. Thank you. So Mick Cox is next, and I didn't get a chance to talk to Mick before, so I have no idea what you're going to talk about, but I'm assuming it's going to be the globalized coordinated response and international relations. Let me just say Mick is a professor of international relations at the LSE. He's got a whole slew of books you can Google him to find out, and he's one of the editors of Critique.
Well, thanks for mentioning the LSE, Susie, because I want to start with a story from the LSE. And on the 4th of November of last year, the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh came to the LSE to open our new wonderful academic building down there off Kingsway. And it was a very interesting meeting, because at one point the Queen, apparently, and this is true, turned to an unfortunate economist standing next to her. And, of course, the LSE Economics Department is one of the greatest in the world. And turned to this unfortunate young man and said to him, why didn't you all see this coming? And this poor guy sort of sat there and looked at the ceiling and looked at the floor, and he shrugged his shoulders and said it was far too complicated to predict the future.
And in a way, I mean, the Queen asked the question, which most economists today probably don't want to ask. I know that everybody can say that some people did see it coming, and there's a few kind of well-known people who managed to do so. But overall, the overwhelming majority of mainstream economists and others obviously failed to see this coming, which in a sense is one part of the crisis, which is actually clearly one part of the crisis, the complete inability of standard economics at any level to have anticipated this. Of course, some did, but they were essentially marginal, in the same way that those who predicted or at least thought about the end of the Soviet Union, like ourselves, were also equally marginal. The mainstream then, of course, was the system would go on in the same way that people thought the system would go on again, and it hasn't. Why didn't you all see all this coming? And all is obviously more than just an American story as well, and I think it's been very important that to American friends have emphasized and stressed the American side of this. But clearly, as I'm sure they would agree, this is not just an American story. This is a global story. I just jotted down what I would call the five empirical measurements of the depth of the crisis. And none of this is terribly original, but it does need to be restated. Just take the year 2008. A massive fall in equity prices. All stock exchanges have fallen dramatically, between 35 and, in the Russian case, 70%, with all of the consequences of that. And none of the equity prices are going up with any degree of certainty. A massive drop in world output. This kind of odd notion that begins on Wall Street and ends up on Main Street. This is now an industrial decline of most remarkable and most rapid. I was looking at figures for the car industry globally, and within 3 months, in the last 3 months of 2008, it's almost been a collapse in demand for worldwide autos, with all the consequence that's going to have, not just for the American auto market, but for the Japanese and others. Demand for Boeing planes fell by 53% over a space of about 2.5 to 3 months. So world output is going down, and it's continuing to drop like a stone. So it's not just a financial crisis, and it's not just an American one. There's been a massive reduction also in foreign direct investment. Again, if you start looking at the figures for FDI around the world, what one sees, frankly, quite simply, over a 3 or 4 month period, but we can trace it back, is simply there's no investment going on. It's falling rapidly. It's falling rapidly. And again, there is no end to this either. It's really quite dramatic, rapid, and at the moment, apparently, irreversible. And this, of course, has also been accompanied, not surprisingly, you wouldn't have thought, also by a worldwide fall in trade. I mean, if you take globalization as more than just an ideology, which I do to a degree, simply a measurement of integration and a measurement of worldwide output and development within an integrated world capitalist economy, then two measures of that was the growth of foreign direct investment in the 1990s and the growth of world trade. It was serious and it was real, and that is now going down. And that is now going down around the world. All the forecasts for worldwide unemployment for the next year alone are just from the point of view of anybody who's going to become unemployed is absolutely horrendous. And I'm sure these figures understate it, but if you even take the ILO figures, that they're predicting an unemployment by the end of this year of something close to 50 million. And again, I think that seriously understates the masking process by which figures are collected. You don't measure unemployment in a number of underdeveloped countries. Do you measure the people who are being kept on at Honda up in the north of England at the moment, who are not working but are being paid? You know, so you've got a massive reduction of the working week. So even these figures seems to be massively understatement. And then most obviously, or most indicatively, of course, a worldwide collapse in nearly all prices. And the two most significant, or two most indicative, well, price collapse, you could take many more. Obviously, the housing prices is at least one indication. But an even more obvious indication is the drop in the price of oil. I mean, if you remember, if you go back to June, oil prices were hovering about 140, and everybody was predicting then, would they now go up? And of course, within the United States, particularly in the State Department, in the strategic part of the American apparatus, they were thinking of all the consequences of high oil prices for Russian foreign policy, for Venezuela, for Iran. And now oil prices are down to about the mid-40s and are probably likely to stay there insofar as you can indicate them. Moreover, for somebody who kind of follows these things quite closely, although not as what I'd call a proper political economist, simply going through the press and talking to people around, and you know, you get to talk to quite a lot, I suppose you might say important people at the NSC, I don't know. But everybody you talk to who is serious, as opposed to an ideologist, says the future is bleak, and they've never known it to be bleaker. I mean, I think the two best indications of this was Alan Greenspan's rather remarkable contribution to the discussion at the end of last year, when this poor man, who had been kind of Superman plus Harry Potter for about 20, well, he looks like Harry Potter, but he's been perceived to be a Superman, suddenly goes before one of the committees of the Senate and says, I'm completely confused, I'm baffled, I've got no idea. And that kind of sent out a clear message. I'd also say, look at the faces on the people now attending Davos. First of all, ask yourself the question, who's not there? Lots of people just don't want to go there this year. For years and years and years, any member of any elite gagged to get a seat at Davos. Now it's the party you don't want to go to any longer. And indeed, looking at their faces, you can understand why. In other words, the ruling class around the world, and not just the United States, is baffled, bewildered, and I think exceedingly frightened. Exceedingly frightened. If the definition of a ruling class is the capacity to rule, then in some senses we could say they have lost the capacity to rule in any real sense of that word, in that wider sense of the word to rule. And if any sense of a crisis is the inability of the ruling class to rule, then I think we are in that situation. Nobody wants to use the word depression, but that's what everybody thinks it is. That's what everybody essentially thinks it is. One of the best-selling books at the moment, interestingly, by the way, is J.K. Galbraith's. I see there's a new, nice new paperback edition out, so, you know, this tells you quite a lot. Now, in the time available, obviously, I'm not going to go into some of the detail which was done by American friends or would be done by Hillel, who looked at some of the deeper causes. But let me just make three or four more general remarks. Firstly, about the historical background to this. It's partly about the question of what is the solution. What is the solution? Now, if we go back to the 1930s, there was a solution to the world depression, or there were a variety of solutions which concluded in World War II. That's what happened. I mean, the solution in one sense was either fascism, as it turned out in Germany. Another form of the solution was Stalinism for the Soviet Union. But the other solution, at least temporarily, was the formation of a series of big blocks. You know, you simply retreated into a series of large blocks, which, however, nonetheless, prepared the way for the coming of World War II. The way out of the world depression, therefore, in the 1930s, wasn't government spending by FDR. As we know, in 38 and 39, by early 1940, the US was going back into a deeper recession or deeper depression. It was the war. It was the war. I mean, there's no other way of thinking about what actually happened. Then, of course, as I've argued elsewhere, one of the things was the reconsolidation of capitalism post-war, of course, was the Cold War. And I've argued about this, and Hillel constantly reminds me to remind myself that it's true, and it's obviously true. Now, if we think in those terms, therefore, what the world had to go through to get out of the world depression was a form of barbarism that even Rosa Luxemburg could not have anticipated. And this, again, I think, adds to the sense of the crisis today. Because I think even some of the more intelligent, there are a few around, even Soros and others, you know, I think they're well aware of the historical nature of the crisis we're now facing. It isn't 12 months. It is a long downturn. It's a long downturn to which they have no solutions. And it's a long downturn to when they look back historically at the kinds of solutions which did occur historically are so horrendous and appalling that they're not even contemplatable. We cannot see another Cold War, and the idea of another World War, or even fascism and Stalinism, is precluded. Now, of course, what they are doing, and as, of course, has been mentioned briefly by our other speakers, is three things. They're spending money like there's no tomorrow. There's massive deficit spending. They're lowering taxes as far as they can. And they're reducing interest rates to zero. Now, none of this, I think, will work in the sense of a solution. But it also does carry a danger, as indeed some of the more, more perceptive or conservative observers have pointed out. What this will create is the conditions of either increasing socialization of the economy. And when the right talk of creeping socialism, in some ways they're right. Because essentially this is what is happening. There's an increase, as indeed Engels himself, if you remember, in the 1870s pointed out, that the way out of a deep economic crisis for capitalism actually, ironically, would be socialization. And I think that's the phase we are now in. And I think this creates, again, a deep sense of crisis. Because they know that one of the ways forward is going to be an increasing process of socialization itself. The other way forward, or at least part of the solution, is going to be inadvertently, unconsciously, will actually be increasing protectionism, which again will undermine the conditions of globalization and global markets. So in a way, either looking back historically to the way we got out of one crisis in the 30s, or looking forward and contemporaneously to the kinds of solutions they're thinking about now, they're actually in a cul-de-sac, a complete utter cul-de-sac, from which they find it very, very difficult to extract themselves. What I think has also added to the depth of the crisis was the fact that they thought they had won in 1989. This, I think, is one of the beautiful ironies of this whole moment, that for 20 years they believed, and believed just generally, that they had won. You know, communism, whatever you want to call it, officially existing socialism, actually existing socialism, to use Barrow's terms, had been seen off in Eastern Europe. The Soviet Union had disintegrated. China re-entered the global economy. The 1990s, for all of its kind of peculiarities and speculative nature, nonetheless produced a massive kind of, not only a massive economic program of development in some parts of the world, it also produced a kind of an extraordinary self-confidence. They were the masters of the universe. And now they find themselves in a situation where they are masters no longer, facing an economic global situation which they could never have anticipated, with answers they don't have, and with potentialities for instability in the world of which they are quite well aware, which brings me on to my next point. Strikes in France over the last few days, the upheavals that occurred in Greece a couple of months ago, are harbingers of things to come. They're harbingers of things to come. Today, the trade union movement, disgracefully in this country, though I wouldn't be ever surprised by the disgraceful character of trade union leadership in this country, is calling a demonstration against foreign workers. Again, this is indicative of what is happening. These are straws in the wind, but they are significant and deep straws in the wind of what is going to happen. And not all this is going to be progressive either. And we've got to be aware of that. But nonetheless, they are very well aware, very conscious of the fact that we're moving into an entirely new phase politically with vast instabilities. One of the things I had a discussion with just quickly on this, Susie, I had an interesting discussion the other day with somebody who's now joined this new administration and said to me, the biggest thing we're worrying about at the moment apart from generally global capitalism, which is probably extremely worrying, the biggest thing they're worrying about at the moment is China. Why are they worrying about China? They're worrying about China not because it's run by a Chinese Communist Party. God forbid, they're perfectly happy with that. Works very well. They're not worrying about human rights. They just couldn't care a tiddly squat about Tibet. What they're worrying about is Chinese growth rates going down. I.e., they're worrying about instability in China. And if you listen to the Chinese Prime Minister earlier in the week, not only did he make some criticism of the United States, he also indicated quite clearly that China is now also entering. In other words, these solutions, which might be other markets, other emerging economies, are themselves now part of the problem. And remember, too, halfway through this crisis, halfway through this crisis, there was an interesting theory called decoupling. Namely, that while the United States and Europe may go down the swanage, other parts of the world economy could, in a sense, pull it up. It was kind of a theory of decoupling. And that has all gone out the window. Nobody any longer believes in that. Just quickly on Barack Obama's election, Barack Obama was elected because of the Lehman Brothers crisis, in my view. It's a very interesting moment in American history, it seems to me. I kind of do boring things like study elections and their statistics. They're quite useful, actually, sometimes. We should do it more often. It's very interesting. If you look, late August and early September, the Republicans and the Democrats were running neck and neck. Within the Democratic Party, there was a real worry they weren't going to win. The Lehman Brothers moment transformed a crisis into a fear of collapse and made possible Barack Obama's election. This has given certainly a short-term boost to the United States. There's no question in terms of what I'm going to say finally, Susie, in the last 3 minutes about the United States. It's certainly given a short-term boost to the United States in terms of its image, in terms of perceptions of America. You know, I mean, there's no his election, I mean, you couldn't have thought of a better candidate for the United States at a moment of crisis. I mean, he's both cemented a large number of Americans around the ruling elites. He's reinstated, at least temporarily, the standing of the United States in the world. I mean, compared to Bush, in the space of a few weeks, Barack Obama has performed miracles. Given that Bush was such a disaster, it seems to me, from the point of view of the American ruling elite and ruling class. Of course, I don't think he's going to come out of this and indeed solve any of the problems that have confronted him, and I think that is also pretty clear. What does this mean for the United States in terms of the future? Very quickly, Susan, I'll shut up. Look, at one level, of course, the United States is bound to remain in some kind of measurable sense of IR, you asked me to say something about it, as the kind of number one power. You know, it means simply its size of its economy, its military capabilities, and all the rest of it. As somebody pointed out to me, it's a kind of rather interesting cynic, he said, look, of course we're powerful, look, we have a housing crisis in Florida and the Russian stock market collapses. That's real power. You know, if you'd started with the subprime in Canada, you wouldn't have had that. You know, it's got to measure something. And of course, the United States will remain, and there's no other great power that's going to replace it. That's for sure. The idea that China is rising to replace it or India, this is just complete bullshit. I mean, I just don't know where this stuff comes from. It's just absolute drivel. So clearly it's not even empirically true. So at one level, the United States is going to remain dominant in that crude sense of, you know, relative power. That's for sure. But clearly at another level, the United States is actually in very steep decline. First of all, it's being blamed for the crisis. So at one level, that is of some significance. Secondly, the American model, if there ever was such a model, is dead. Its capacity to do things is lessened around the world, as we are seeing in Afghanistan, or we've seen their retreat from Iraq. And finally, and here I'll finish, because the world is going to become more unstable because of this crisis, its ability to resolve those problems and contradictions of crisis, which will, I think, get deeper and deeper and deeper, will be less and less and less.
Thank you, Nick. Very good. You answered some of the questions I brought up in the introduction, okay. Especially that, you know, the French workers and the Greek youth with their anti-capitalist revolt, and the question, of course, becomes is where is it going to go from here? Whether it's going to be nihilist, anarchist, social democratic, or hopefully socialist. With Hillel, I think one of the important things to address, Rahm Emanuel recently said that a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. And which could bring along all sorts of solutions. So Hillel is going to address the nature of the crisis and the fundamental instability of capitalism.
Thank you. Well, I suppose the first question is it good for us or bad for us? And it's good for critique.
There you go. Alan Greenspan now buys critique, I guess.
I'm saying that because in the last few months I've had two emails from former members of the editorial board. I stress by former members.
Right, the renegades.
The guy who actually proposed critique
and is now on the board of the Aga Khan Foundation, amazingly, sent an email saying the next issue has to be on the crisis. And then just a few days ago, a former member who's become the board again, something else, said, sent me an email, asked me the question, is this the big one? Well, yes, it's the big one.
It's the big Lebowski.
Yes. Well, of course, I agree with everything that Mitch just said. And I hope that, having quoted me, asking him to write the next version of his famous piece, he will now do so. Yes. The question that I'm trying to address is not to go over the actual course of the crisis and talking whether it's good or bad. Speaking to my brother, and I was telling him that in the last month that I'm now giving a 10-week course on the crisis. I've given any number of lectures on it, and most people here have actually heard me talk about it, so I'm not going to repeat the kind of details that I've been giving anyway. So, of course, me telling my brother this, he said, oh, well, okay, the crisis is good for you. It's true. So, it's good for us politically and bad for us personally. Well, underlying the crisis, of course, lies the, to use the overused word, the contradictions of capitalism. And Mick has brought out the most important aspect of it, I think. Capitalism in its decline is necessarily unstable. Now, curiously, the left had given up on that. Now, sometimes I've seen, as written by Bob Brenner, the idea that the left had been expecting a crisis every day or every year or whatever, but that's just not true. The WRP, the late WRP, did expect that, but that was exceptional. If you look at what Mandel said, late Ernest Mandel, or Tony Clift, SWP, and so on, they didn't expect it, then they didn't think it was possible. So, in general, the left had given up on the idea of the instability of capitalism. For most of the left, the instability of capitalism is simply given by the discontent of the population, beginning and end. It wasn't looked at in objective terms. And insofar as it did, to begin with the point, in Britain in particular, the dominant view, for no good reason, was that we had a falling rate of profit. The concept of falling rate of profit was entirely fetishized. Let's say there was a forever falling rate of profit. Now, if that's the view you hold, it's difficult to understand why it wasn't minus 100% by now. After all, Marx had put forward the conception in the third volume of Capital, remember, 150 years ago. So 150 years at minus 1% is minus 150%, if you actually want to go that way. Obviously, Marx didn't mean that. And equally obviously, although the so-called counteracting factors, and I assume everybody has read this stuff, the counteracting factors, which has been pointed out, wasn't called counteracting factors by Marx, but by Engels, are inbuilt into the law itself. And in that case, although it's automatically the case that if you accept the labor theory of value, in the very long run, there will cease to be value. That's perfectly true. So if machines make machines, you no longer have people working within the economy except the supervisor or God knows what, you'll no longer have value. That's true. So the rate of profit has become zero because the workers are no longer exploited, no longer have value. That's true. But that could take 300 years or 500 years or who knows, 100 years. And that's obviously not the case today. However, the point and the problem with the falling rate of profit fetishistic viewpoint is it doesn't interrelate with history. And that's inbuilt into the law. It has to do so, and if it doesn't do so, it ceases to be Marxist. Now, if you look at, for instance, the work of Chris Harman, or the SWP as a whole, it's very much based on this idea of the falling rate of profit, beginning and end. And effectively, it doesn't give an explanation. But you don't know why it didn't happen in 1990 or 1995 or any other time. They add little bits and pieces, but it then becomes a bit like the explanation of how the sun went around the earth in the first century AD or something. So, I don't rule it out as a limit. It, there is a limit involved, but that's as far as one can go. The second aspect, just to finish this thing off and finish off the question of the federalization of the underlying causes, is the fact that we can't actually calculate surplus value simply because the statistics we get are not in value terms. Now, you can try and work it out one way or another, but you would probably require an enormous institute to actually do that, to translate the statistics back into surplus value itself, rather than profits, interest, and rent, add that up. Of course, we know there are a whole series of other things which would fit into profits, like the enormous salaries of CEOs, etc., etc. You can just expand it almost ad infinitum, which in a sense the Monthly Review School did without actually knowing what they were doing. So it's possible to do it, but no one, I think, has done it, even though some people claim it's obviously not true, so we can't actually calculate. Since we can't calculate, we can't actually know it. The second aspect of profits, quite simply, is that even if it were possible, we'd actually know what it is. And given the fact that in the 1990s, so much of the profits was hidden one way or another, the profits were either increased in order to get increased valuation on the stock exchange, or reduced in order to reduce taxation. People might be paid shares or whatever, which wasn't counted, takes an example. But there are 101 ways of fixing the profits. The result of that, again, is though, while you could sit down and do it, I don't know anybody who's actually done it. So the result is that although we can talk about profits, you can't just continue along that line without providing genuine statistics and genuine value terms, and we don't have them. So simple statements simply reflect the bankruptcy of certain groups or certain theories. I think that's as far as it goes. So, what are we talking about then? In the first instance, seems to take the form of surplus capital. I think that's what people have been talking about. That's to say, capital which has to be held and not invested, because there isn't any way to invest. Because if they do invest, the rate of return is just too low for them to actually continue with it, or simply because they regard the risk as too great. And we know the levels of surplus capital are absolutely enormous, not just in pension funds today. I think what Michael Hudson referred to, we've been getting what I call the cannibalistic aspect of finance capital, the rise of private equity, which has indeed been taking companies out from the stock exchange. But that's enormous. That didn't exist before. So we're talking about then the rise of surplus capital in this form, its inability to invest in this way. Now, why? What's going on in this? Well, in the first instance, we did have this shift towards finance capital. I know that Jack said that he doesn't agree with the concept. Well, obviously I do. I think it's absolutely a fundamental Marxist concept going back to Hilferding, adopted by Lenin, used by Trotsky, by the way, in 1905, without actually theorizing at the time. It's a fundamental Marxist concept, which I think gives a considerable understanding of where we are. And as I understand it, it is financial capital, that's, say, the stage within the circulation of capital going from production over to the final sale, this intermediate stage where you have for financial capital, it's where the financial capital has become dominant over the entire process. Finance capital has become dominant. And I think that is true over the world. When Nick's talking about U.S. capital being dominant, we're talking of U.S. financial capital being dominant. And that has remained to the present day. Previous to that, you had British finance capital being dominant. As we know, in the late 70s, the bourgeoisie effectively switched, whether through governments or directly, to finance capital away from their growth strategy. And at that point, of course, or at this point, the left has been divided as to why this was actually the case. In my view, it was, as it were, a response to the revolts of 1968, working class action at this time, and the fact that working class being more militant was getting better conditions or better wages. It was he saw it could no longer hold the fort in that form, and so it switched back to finance capital, which from this point of view is a strategy of control, which from this point of view was originally introduced by Britain in 1870. That's quite different from what was argued by Lenin or Hilferding, of course, because I think that was simply wrong in terms of Germany and Britain. Britain was finance capital rather than Germany. So, they switched in order to maintain control, and the whole so-called neoliberal project, the changeover to control over labour, and the various forms that it's taken in the world, are forms by which finance capital wasn't controlled. What effectively happened now is the explosion of this particular strategy. And there is no other strategy, even if they are trying to work their way towards it, they're trying to find nothing, what Mises described as different ways which they're trying to go, but there is no way to go in this particular thing. So what is underlying this is the fact that the different aspects of instability of capitalism, which would be classically, when we look at a crisis, underconsumption, disproportionality, falling rate of profit, continue to operate. What happened in the period after whatever it is, 1870s, beginning of the 20th century, was that war became a crucial method of stability. And of course, as far as you had direct war, it became unstable, but Mick's description of Cold War is absolutely right, it seems to me. And Stalinism did effectively hold the fort. It isn't just a question, a technically economic question. It was that the Communist Party has played a crucial role in controlling unions, in preventing working class taking power, in collaborating with the bourgeoisie. It was ideological. It was direct in preventing the working class acting. It meant that the bourgeoisie could rely effectively on Stalinism and prevent anything happening. It meant that they could allow a period of growth as occurred after 1945. So it did act as a means of control. It did act as a means of stability. Both technically in economic terms, you can go through the way war goes, the Cold War in particular, which was a wonderful way of maintaining capitalism, because you didn't actually have a war, so you could go on building and building and building, and then destroying it every 3 months as being obsolete. Didn't even have to go to war for the purpose, which has other problems. And in fact, of course, it took care of all three aspects of the of any crisis for a period of time. The problem, of course, the Cold War has come to an end. That's why I say Mick simply has to write in the next version. And Stalinism itself has come to an end. That automatically creates instability with the system as a whole. The second aspect, of course, which created a relative degree of stability was the third aspect of the Cold War and Stalinism, is the welfare state and social democracy. It did stabilize capitalism for a time. That has ceased to exist to a very large extent. It can no longer do so. So, if one looks at these aspects of instability, then the phenomenal form appears to be underconsumption. And, of course, we have a number of articles arguing that you have, of course, the Monthly Review School, who have always been based on underconsumption, have an article by a guy called Dan Hines, which is in the New Left Review, I see, arguing for underconsumption. You have Rick Wolf of Amherst also arguing in terms of underconsumption. Well, historically, Marxists have always found underconsumption a very difficult argument to go along with, for the simple reason that one has to explain what happens to the profits, to the investment side of it. And the underconsumptionists generally don't. Sweezy tried to argue from him in his underconsumption theory that it applied over a long period of time or over a period of time and gradually had an effect. Well, that is the issue. What happens to the investment, the profits involved, which goes back to the question of surplus capital. Why couldn't it be invested? Well, historically, again, the argument there put forward by Lenin was because of the absence of competition, monopoly of a downward sloping curve, so they couldn't simply invest. They therefore exported capital. That's basically true. That's not the only reason in the present time. We have to add the point that the welfare state itself does tend to limit it, even if we may support workers getting higher wages, better conditions, and so forth, and the fact that people shouldn't be declared redundant, factories shouldn't be closed. The fact is, if that capitalist faces that, he isn't going to invest. One can go through a series of ways under modern conditions where investment is more limited than it would have been. You would expect under classic conditions that investment would go into raising productivity and so make the firm more competitive, but we don't have that kind of condition today. Say the earlier logic was the export of capital to a limited degree, they would say it's been able to occur, but even that today is actually limited. It's limited by the fact that you no longer have colonies, or you can export to China, but only up to a point. And look at the rate of profit in China. For a long time, profits in China, of Western banks in China, were actually very low. I don't know what they were. Now it must be very low indeed now. But maybe last year they went up. But from what I could see, they remained low. They were investing for the future, as it were, which of course turns out to be the wrong future. So, in other words, there are limits to investment. That's what one really has to look at. It goes back to this question of surplus capital. Let's say the superficial form of it is indeed under consumption, but that's purely superficial. We have to go back to investment and see why the investment is limited, why, in fact, the capitalist class didn't want to invest in real production, and therefore switch to finance capital, which did act as a means of raising the rate of its exploitation and raising, therefore, the rate of profit, contrary to the decline in railroad profit theory, as it were. We know that profits went up in very general terms, and certainly we can say that the rate of exploitation went up, that's to say wages in relation to profits actually dropped. We know that it worked, but it could only work up to a point, obviously. They couldn't keep increasing the rate of exploitation. That is what ultimately lies behind it. From there, finance capital switched to cannibalism, as they would call it. What it did is went into these derivatives. They went into itself. They invested in themselves, which is impossible, of course. It became, Michael Hudson referred to parasitism. I think his comparison is absolutely wonderful. That's exactly what does happen.
It's unfair,
absolutely right.
Unfair on parasites.
It may be unfair on parasites. I think that is what's happened. Inevitably, the brain exploded or whatever, and the pieces were left. Inevitably, you couldn't have $596 trillion of derivatives without disequilibrium, the whole thing falling to pieces. That is what happened. But that was the external form, the final form, as it were. We already had an economy which was groaning, an economy which was breaking down effectively, or the contradictions of capitalism, if you look at it, to use the word, I hope correctly. The conditions of land were already showing themselves. The form of this fantastic explosion in finance capital in its changed aspect, I think Michael's right, is a changed aspect, most particularly showed itself in the last 6 years, where you have credit default swaps increasing from, I think it's 1 trillion to 64 trillion. And in terms of derivatives, it's 200 trillion to 596 trillion at the end of 2007, which makes no sense whatsoever. No sense at all. So it's almost as if the brain holding the parasite had gone completely mad. Inevitably, that aspect must break down and had to break down. That's why the form of the crisis is a financial form. But the idea that the finance is driving the crisis itself is just wrong. There's something behind the financial crisis as I've been describing it. And it isn't the credit crunch which is causing the crisis. On the contrary, it's the real economy causing the crisis. The first phase of it was financial. And of course, all crises have the first phase has been the financial crisis. That is what has happened. The first phase was the financial crisis. We're now in the, as it were, the real economy or the productive economy as per the crisis. Quite obviously, it's going to get deeper as people have been described. That's the way it seems to me. Thank you.
Well done. I'm really pleased all of our panelists have been disciplined. And it's now 1:31. We have an hour. So We can take questions and contributions. Maybe we can open a window or something, give us a little break, if you can handle it for another hour before we break. Please identify yourself as you ask questions, and I'll collect the questions, maybe take three or so at a time, and not limited just to the audience, but to other people on the panel who may have questions as well. Okay. One, two, three. That's the first one.
My name is Tony Norfield. I spent about 20 years working in banks, so I know how the financial system works. But there are a couple of issues that came up with several of the speakers, which I'm not sure how far there are solid views on their parts, or how far it's just a form of expression, because it seemed to me that there was too much of a distinction made between like sort of industrial capital and finance capital, and as if the finance capital bit, or the bank bit, or however you want to say it, is some horrible thing compared to the more the nasty bit of capitalism as compared to carbon production or something like that. I think some of the early sort of definitions of finance capital and everything are kind of interesting in this respect. So you find that, whether it be General Motors Acceptance Corporation, Ford Motor Credit, or whatever, all the big corporations are all part of the financial system anyway, and there isn't that kind of distinction you can make. And I think that it'd be a mistake for us to give any sort of concessions on, bachelor banks or something like that, because it just becomes a kind of sort of a populist reaction that we're probably going to see politically. And related to that, the whole issue of speculation. I mean, speculation is just an inevitable component of a market system. You can't get around it. And I think we need to be careful on the way we're talking about speculation as well. That clearly, it's exploded all kinds of transaction numbers that are interesting large. But all of this actually enveloped the whole of society. Joe Sixpack with the subprime mortgage, or people speculating on real estate in the UK and all kinds of things, right? So it's not a bunch of evil speculators. It's part of what was drawn in, the whole of the capitalist system. And I think that it's just important to be clear politically that we are talking about, obviously, the capitalist system and the crisis it's in. It's not a case of one bit versus another, because I think with the move towards a nationalistic politics that we're going to be seeing in the coming years, we're going to get all of these debates going as to who caused the crisis, who won our bit, and fighting against others. There is a real rise of nationalism. The speed with which people like Gordon Brown have given up on globalization as a function of what we're now facing.
Hi, yes. My name is Sir Cooper. I can't understand the reluctance, both on the left and on the bourgeois commentators, to use the word depression, because it must be is a depression, and it's very likely to be actually far, far greater than the depression of the 1930s. And defining isn't just a question of world, workplace, actually, conditions our strategic outlook for the next 10 years, very important for Marxism, and contribute to make some sort of change. Now, words like depression and recession are conventional. They're not something we have to know about redefinition of. Nevertheless, for practical purposes, we can adopt a working definition, or a good working definition, which shall we say has two sort of aspects to it. First is that, as Marx says, we understand recessions as corrective measures, not as something bad, not as an accident, perhaps capitalism or something got wrong in capitalism. These were attempts to overcome certain balances that have accumulated in the system. I would define, therefore, depression as a whole series of recessions that have been postponed, mainly by government intervention, and that lead to a situation, as we've had in 1992, or as we were in the country, now to an accumulation of imbalances that cannot be resolved in the usual way. The second aspect, the reason I think this is the depression, is because clearly the corrective mechanisms of recovery after really not working. We've spent billions, well, trillions really up to now, and have that effect. The government said it won't already have that effect. There isn't a single economist in the world that today has any point much faith that the amounts of money that we're going to pour into the economy in all countries are going to have an effect. And people hope that it will, but there is no optimism to say this is working this way. So we have massive amounts of corrective measures coming and have no effect. I think that's a clear sign that this is a big issue, not just a normal recession. Why do I think it's going to be far, far worse? Well, part of the way that these recessions have been postponed has actually created enormous imbalances in the world economy. The deficit between China and China in terms of treasury devices and dollars between the Asian countries and the USA are just one example. And it's very, very difficult to resolve these problems. In a way, the world economy in the 1930s was in a much better position because you could have national economics. So if it had been sorted out in some way, something could have been done. I still think there would have been a recession, etc., but it would be more a depression than 1930s. Today, that is impossible. This is entirely in the realm of politics now to make a decision. Yet the only way you can now pull out of the world avoid the depression is now to have a discussion on the world level to sort out. And I think that's very difficult. There are going to nationalist box. How long is this going to take? Well, how long did it take for the world to move from being neoliberal to being positive? That's about 12 months, and I think almost in the same period we're going to get that slide to economic nationalism. The second aspect, I think, also, is that capitalism is a lot larger. People have confidence or kid themselves that this is not going to be a depression, it's not going to be a return to the good. Because, of course, we've got a lot more wealth. You don't seem to understand, actually, that it's the wealth of capitalism that creates the wealth of the crisis very much more than the 1930s. I'll just give you one example of one point on that. In 1930, 20% of the world's population lived under capitalism. But even within this 20%, there were large groups of people that lived between subsistence and capitalism. And I'll give two examples. The Malaysian peasant had sort of almost three, lived in three economies. One is a subsistence economy based on rice and vegetables. A rice economy producing rice for the market when the price was right, and working on rubber plantations to be able to pay in currency British tax imposition. When the recession came, all that happened is that the Malaysian peasant receded into subsistence. So although these were hard times in the 1930s, he could survive. Much the same happened in France, because industrialization in France had been very late. What happened is that the workers retained actually very close links with their family in the rural economy. So as factories closed down in the cities, they simply receded into the countryside to creating a great deal of underemployment, but at least they had a roof over their head, they could eat, etc., and they were sheltered. There are, in fact, no proper statistics for France for unemployment or the effects of the depression, because it just simply melted away. Well, today, 80% of the world's population live in capitalism. I guess that a large, large proportion of that do not have any means, subsistence means, that they receive. Right now, it's now become very, very popular for middle class people to keep themselves that they're going to have an allotment, their gardening to this is absolutely ridiculous. They in a peculiar way, or comical way, I should say, they realise that the economy, the capitalist economy, is going to crumble, and they're trying to defend themselves by receding into some sort of subsistence. But of course, it's not there. The living standards of people are very much higher. So it's not a question of just eating potatoes and cabbages, you know, we'd be happy with that. There is no possibility now of escaping. I think, therefore, the dimension, the global dimension of capitalism, cannot be
helped. Okay, thank you. I recently had the privilege of interviewing Leander Prey, 101 years old, a UN from Chicago, we'll know who he is. He agrees with you. He started out by remembering the depression, and he said, of course, it's going to be much worse this time. And anyway, go ahead.
My question will be a record of brevity.
Okay, and please identify yourself.
Yeah, Fred Harrison. I'm one of those marginalised forecasters who did get it right 10 years ago. And everything that's happened is precisely according to that forecast. My question is to the two American speakers. Mr. Rasmus was suggesting that there's no way for the system to recover itself, but he didn't explain why. Bearing in mind that the banks went bust at a greater rate over previous crises over the last 200 years in America, far more than over the last 12 months, why is the system so debilitating that it can't in fact recover? Dr. Hudson seems to have implied a theory of why the system can maintain, preserve itself, and if that is the case, it would be worth elaborating that.
Right. Okay, so we'll take, that's the first round. I'll let the panel respond, and then we'll take another question. So, Jackie.
A couple points here. Speculation. All investment has been its very nature speculation. You're making a decision in the present about a return in the future, right? And you're unsure about the future. But even Keynes made a mistake. Speculation is small as the speculation for greatness. What we're looking at now is an intensification of speculation. Remember the debt buildup at the other side of the
It's
extreme leveraging. It's extreme leveraging. Because of securitization, which is something that's just really come into its own in the last 8 years, and we really think of securitization as pyramiding of investment, and that's where derivatives come in. You can speculate on top of something and package it into something else and speculate again. Leveraging is the key. Debt is the key, but leverage, extreme leverage, the speculative investment, and this has grown to a much greater share than it's ever been before, for a number of reasons. One, there are no international capital control limits. So it's enabled it to globalize. The monetary policy has fed the debt with low interest rates chronically for a number of years. And the income shift has made the investor class so much more money capital available to speculate that it can't find outlets in sufficient outlets, that's 20% returns, that it would in ordinary investment. So, yes, it's true. It's the nature of capitalist system. Speculation is there, but it has changed. This is part of the change in the structure of finance capital in the last 30 years, has moved it more in that direction. And leveraging and debt is more of an element ever before. When I talked about why was this thing so fast, so deep, so virulent, really, the depth of the crisis is because of the magnitude of the debt buildup, and the rate of spread is because of the securitization and the elimination of international capital limits on flows. And the duration is because of this liquidity strategy that they've been pursuing for 18 months, which puts off the whole resolution and drags it out. The other question, I think, on depression. I disagree with you. This is not a depression. This is not. This is not a recession. This is something in between. If you just look at the indicators, some very simple indicators, recession is two to four quarters, maybe 1-2% drop in GDP, less than 10% unemployment. Depression, 40-50 quarters, 10% annual GDP drop, 20% plus unemployment. We aren't near that yet. But there are signs that we could evolve in that direction. But we got to be careful not being too hyperbolic about all this stuff and jump into the conclusion, this is the big one, it is going to collapse, and so forth. I mean, we got to go by what the data and the evidence actually is. It's much more serious, but it's not a collapse. I didn't really say it couldn't recover. I said that the fiscal and monetary policy has failed, clearly. Fiscal policy, to the extent it's been employed by Obama at this particular juncture, will fail. You need 20% plus government spending. You need a bigger involvement in the state. And I'm not convinced that they won't find a solution with greater state participation and support for the whole profit system. But that state support has to play a role.
to generate at least 40% of GDP instead of the historic 20% we've had over the last 40 years. That could come in new forms of public ownership. It could, which is not socialization. It's not socialism. In fact, in some cases, you could really ask, is it really nationalism or just the state supporting the private sector? You've got to be careful between those three possibilities. A last clarification. When I said I don't like the financialization concept because I think we overdo it, as this gentleman said over here, your industrial companies are deep into the whole financial process, and many of them make more profits for financial speculation than the banks do. I mean, the whole commercial paper market, the repo market, there's all kind of markets, and many of them make more from their financial investments than their industrial investments. So financialization, in the sense of, the banks and the financial intermediaries are now all-powerful, and they've gobbled up the industrial capitalists, a la Hilferding, I think is wrong. So I don't reject financialization, but the way the term is used, I think, is improper. And finally, I think this crisis is much bigger than just state and local finance and the mortgage markets. When you talk about the financial crisis, we tend to look at the land and the mortgage markets, but it's all kind of short-term credit markets that the problem exists in. The solution has to be broader than just the solution that attacks state and local finance, although they are really impacted seriously.
Michael will go next. He has to get on a plane.
After this, I have to jump on a plane to Malaysia. Regarding the first comment on financial, don't blame the banks entirely. I agree with the first comment. When you have a parasite and a host, it's a symbiosis. They need both. And what you have is a larger and larger, essentially, rentier layer on top of industrial capitalism. Now, Hillel mentioned the falling rate of profit, and I think basically that's a way of thinking about how the system is changing. When Marx talked about the falling rate of profit, he was really talking about the distribution of cash flow, that is, income over current costs of production, as between that the recapture of capital invested in machinery and how much is left over for profit. And Marx believed that as industrial capitalism grew, it would become more and more highly mechanized, and capital would be a rise in capital per worker. And if there's a rise in capital worker, the investor, like a bondholder, when you cash in your bond, you not only get interest, you get your principal back. The capitalist had to recover the investment in the machinery, and that would increase the role of the capital recapture would rise relative to wages. And therefore, more and more of the what now economists call EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. The profits would fall as that. That's a helpful way of looking at things. And in fact, every Wall Street analyst, they're taught in business schools to look exactly at this as for the sum. But in what the classical economists and Marx had, in addition to the labor theory of value, was the rent theory of price. Rent is an excess of market price over and above the actual cost value of production. And the aim of classical economics and of Marxism was to bring prices down to what Marx called the socially necessary price of production. And the aim, not only of Marx, but of the reformers, of Henry George, of John Stuart Mill, was to get rid of the rentier class and what Keynes himself called euthanasia of the rentier. And the idea is that you would that as you would make land rent the source of taxation, as you would nationalize monopolies, and as the government would develop the natural monopolies, you would have less and less rentier income, and in fact that was the aim in England of the parliamentary reform of 1909 and 10 that failed. It was the aim of classical economics. Now, what has happened since World War I is an interruption of this process. You have a increasing ratio of price to value. So within EBITDA, you have a rising role not of
depreciation and amortization. Do you know that 80% of what depreciation is in America, 80% of the depreciation is redepreciation of buildings? It's in real estate, because the largest capital investment is real estate. And this is a financialized process because it's sort of a vampire economy. Once you finish depreciating a building, and under the Reagan tax law, you could fully depreciate a building in 7 years. So from 1945 to 2000, the real estate sector as a whole paid zero income tax. It was all depreciation because of the they could take off their the interest. So real estate was run as essentially a public service. This is the kind of if you're going to talk about the falling rate of profit, you have to realize that the largest capital investment in the economy is in real estate, and what's called capital gains in reality are land gains. The U.S. statistics don't reflect this, and one of the Representative Kucinich has a Monetary Transparency Act before Congress now. We're trying to criticize the Federal Reserve statistics. It was said that there are good statistics on what's happening in the economy. There aren't good statistics in the economy. The whole idea is to avoid having good statistics, but to create a fictitious view of the economy on which the income tax system is laid, a fictitious view, so that it appears as if the capitalists don't make any profit at all. If you're a capitalist, you love Marx's falling rate of profit, because profits are taxed. You want to take your cash flow in a way that aren't taxed. That's simple. No wonder the Marxists became the rising stars on Wall Street. They knew what it was all about. They just sort of didn't use the euphemisms that people have, like free market. What is a free market? Well, essentially, the parasite frees the host from all this trouble of having to make decisions. A free market is one where there is no government regulation, no taxation, and finally, you have the ideal of centralized planning. The centralized planning takes place in Wall Street. Without any government intervention, without oversight, in the United States, 50 attorney generals sought to bring criminal charges against Countrywide Financial, Bank of America, and the others. President Bush said this is in violation of federal regulation under an 1862 clause of the National Bank Act. The federal government has authority over all state governments to regulate the banking system, and our regulator says there's nothing you can do. Every state criminal law against every bank was thrown out of court in America. This is the free market. Finally, you don't have the government interfering with this anymore. You can do everything you want, and you have centralized planning. It's a social. No wonder they call it socializing the banking system. I have to run to off Malaysia to tell them what to do to avoid all of this. So I'm sorry. I can't. And here are the rest of your comments. But thank you for inviting me.
Oh, thanks for being here too, Michael.
Sure. Oops. We'll repeat it
hell
in New York.
Hell.
Yeah.
Come in,
see you. Have a good trip.
Off to Malaysia. That's good.
Okay.
Thank you, man. Yeah. Okay. Look, the words we use, I mean, whether you want to call it recession or depression, it seems to be neither here nor there, really. Neil Ferguson, of course, has just written actually not a bad book about the history of money. One of the better books I think he's done for years. Given that most of the others were rubbish. But he's actually come up with an interesting word because he doesn't know what to call it either. He calls it repression. So that we can play around with the terminologies. And I think American Friend is losing part of the plot here on this particular issue. I mean, firstly, the very fact that people are making these historical parallels, and they've not done this for 40 years, tells us something. And the people who are making these parallels, frankly, is not the SWP necessarily. It's actually the bourgeoisie themselves. So, you know, in some fundamental way, they know that something fundamental has changed, that the epoch into which they are now moving is fundamentally different, and that the old mechanisms of control and management and the whole assumptions from the 1990s have gone. they are very well aware of this, and this is why, of course, you know, I'm saying the Galbraith book is selling so well and why people are thinking about it. Now, of course, it's not the same. You know, that's obviously the case. It's clearly not going to be exactly the same, and that's part of the import of what I was saying. You know, if we look at the differences, they are huge, that's for sure. You know, there is, I do not believe that there is no longer a Stalinist solution. There is no USSR. That makes it different. One could not imagine, say, Germany today or any other country utilizing the means of destroying the left. And indeed, in some senses, you don't need those kinds of solutions because there is no organized left to the same degree as there was in the 1930s. The left is not a threat as it was politically in the 1930s. That is a difference. The role of the United States in the world economy, that is different. The nature of Europe, that is different. The European Union has made a huge difference to the transformation. You know? And I think, as one of our friends pointed out, you know, many more people live within capitalism, including countries which formerly were anti-capitalist, the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, and China. So all the things are different. I accept the point. But I don't think that is the issue, really, what we use. I mean, it's the question of, simply as I tried to stack it up at the beginning, simply in terms of the empirics. You know, if you don't think there's a depression, go to Reykjavik. You know, try Iceland. I mean, you know, the country collapsed. Now, you might say it's a small country, but it's an indicator of something really profoundly problematic in the system. You know, a number of countries in East Central Europe who were the hope for the future after 1989 are now in the deepest trouble possible. I've just come back from Spain, where unemployment is sitting around 13 to 15%. And is bound to rise higher and higher and higher as both the construction industry and the tourist industry simply fall apart this year by the degrees of 30 to 40%. If you take even the simplest indicators, however useful or useless they are, simply look at stock markets over the last 12 months. Wall Street dropped from 13,000 to 8. The UK stock exchange has dropped from well over 6 to just hovering around 4. We've seen 30, 40, 50, 60% drops in stock markets. You know, this again has got to be an indication of something. Now, you may not want to call it a depression, but it seems to me that this is a clear indication of a very sharp, massive retraction, to which, as I also argued in my presentation, there doesn't seem to be any immediate answer in terms of the historic answers that were provided, however barbaric they happen to be, in the shape of World War and the Cold War. So, and moreover, as I try to argue, and again, I don't care what you really call it, to be perfectly honest, I don't see they've got any easy way out of this either, in their own terms. There are no easy ways out of this. And again, what we are therefore seeing is the economists continuing to drop like a stone. I mean, this is what is most dramatic, and not just on the financial sector, as you pointed out. It's clearly in the industrial areas as well, in terms of airplanes, in terms of car industries, in terms of steel production. You know, you look around the world today, this is massive, and as you point out, it is absolutely global. If we just take the UK economy, after all, I don't know what's going on in the UK economy at the moment, but it's going to be a depression. I listened to a very interesting discussion this morning on the future of UK manufacturing. Now, UK manufacturing currently represents about 14 to 15% of the UK economy. And what economists and others are now worrying about is that even that limited amount of manufacturing capital may not be there in about 2 years' time. Now, that's peculiar to Britain, I know, because of the overwhelming dominance of the financial sector. And by the way, Hillel and I don't always agree on everything, but I mean, if one kind of takes the question of finance capital, one of the reasons the decline in Britain is going to be so massive and so much greater than anybody else is precisely because of its dependency on the financial sector and finance capital. I mean, that's again, is a very, very important indicator. So, again, I mean, I don't really care what one calls it. I mean, one's just simply got to measure it and understand it and also think forward. And thinking forward, it is very difficult. And again, this is coming not from me, you know, or anything else like that. It is simply coming from looking at what people themselves who are trying to run this system are saying themselves to themselves, and not just in private, and not just at Davos, but what they're saying is they just do not know the way out of this. And secondly, what they're also well aware of, is that this situation promises huge political instabilities, some of which we've seen indicators of, say, in Greece, or see indications in France where there's an organized labor movement, but we'll see other forms of this. We'll see other forms of this, and not all of them, as I said earlier on, will be progressive. I mean, for instance, if you just take one state for which it's extraordinarily important in IR terms, Pakistan. At the moment, NATO and the US are fighting what everybody now recognizes as an unwinnable war in Pakistan. In Afghanistan, which clearly has consequences for Pakistan. If we see a further deterioration, as we're bound to, in terms of trade, in terms of the financial sector, and the collapse of the middle class, and collapse of the economic situation in Pakistan, which is very likely under current conditions, then the possibility of stabilizing Pakistan are going to be impossible. The knock-on effects of that are just going to be huge for the region and for the political international relationships, say, into Afghanistan and into India. Now, all of these things then add up to a picture, a composite global picture of a massive downturn, with no easy way out of this over the next 3 to 4 to 5 years. Of course, until there is an alternative, the system won't collapse. No, systems don't collapse. We're not some Zamenhof theorists. They don't collapse. You know, the system can go on. It'll simply go on at a much lower level. You know, the lower level will be, you know, 30 or 40% lower than where we are now. Well, that to me adds up to something close to a depression. And it will carry with it some very deep political consequences as well.
Okay, and Hillel. And then just before you go, Hillel, then it's now 2 o'clock. We have this session until 2:30. We take, what, half an hour break? Or an hour? I don't know. Okay, half an hour break. We come back for more. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I actually agree with you that we're going in for a depression, but I'll take that second. The first question is the question of finance capital itself. Well, nobody's arguing that greedy bankers caused the crisis. That is just stupid. And nobody's arguing in a moral sense that being a banker is bad. That's equally stupid. And the argument isn't that therefore you build up industry as opposed to another country and therefore end up as a nationalist. That isn't the argument. The argument comes from Marx, where he's very clear that finance, among other things, is unproductive. In other words, it doesn't produce value. Anything to do with exchange does not produce value. Now, that must follow from the labor theory of value. And if you try to argue that exchange produces value, you abandon the labor theory of value. If you abandon the labor theory of value, I don't think there's anything left of Marxism. Nobody has to be a Marxist, nobody's compelling you. But if you are a Marxist, then it follows, as night follows from day, that the financial sector is unproductive. That's why it is a parasite. It can only get the value from the rest of the economy. That is why it is unproductive. And so far as it extracts value from the rest of the economy, beyond the simple function of circulation. Beyond that, it is a parasite. Now, of course, what it has done in this particular period is turn on itself, extracting value from the productive sector, and therefore, to a degree, diverting it and stunting it. Now, that's been the historic argument from Hilferding, from even before Hilferding, actually. It was the common viewpoint before Hilferding that finance capital had taken over. As I say, you can see Trotsky using it without actually defining it. But the theorist of it, of course, is actually Lenin rather than Hilferding. And on that point, since Michael Hudson talked of the Central Committee of the Bourgeoisie effectively sitting in Wall Street planning, that's in Hilferding. It's not new. One of the points that Hilferding is making is that once you have finance capital, it can meet with itself and organize capitalism. Lenin argues that Hilferding went too far with it, but it is true that with the development of finance capital, for the first time, capitalism is able to become almost fully conscious and organized to an extent, not to the whole extent to which Hilferding was arguing, which he was arguing effectively for a managed capitalism. But of course, it's gone further than in the period of Hilford. That is true. But the point is that finance capital, when it came into being, and really came into being in Britain, in this respect, actually Lennon and Hilferding were wrong, was a strategy adopted at the time in order to cope with the rising working class. And it did involve, as one major strategy, the export of capital, which, of course, as we all know, wasn't only to the colonies, but was to Germany, Sweden, the United States, and so forth. But it did mean that capital in Britain was therefore limited, stunted, and changed. That is the case. So one has to look at it in these terms. One can't simply say banks are good or banks are equally good to as manufacturers. Of course, money is essential to a capitalist economy. And the money part of circulation is essential. But the fact that it is essential doesn't make it productive. And that is the essential point. And with that, it has its own particular role, which is why Michael Hudson is absolutely right to call it parasitic. But of course, that comes from this historic socialist movement all along. But it doesn't say that banks are therefore bad, or that banks even caused the crisis. I was arguing they didn't. And there's nothing wrong with banks. No, nobody should be ashamed of being a banker.
Banksters, they were called the other day. Banksters.
On the question of depression, I actually agree with a lot of what actually was said by Cecile here. I think that's right. I mean, clearly, of course, one can use any word you like. It was Engels who said that the depressions are getting deeper. Now, of course, if we look at it as a depression, that appears to be the case. It is globalized in a way it wasn't even in, as you were pointing out, it wasn't in the 1929 depression. And by the way, just as a side issue, Preobrazhensky actually wrote more or less along your lines, talking about the modern sector and the more backward agricultural sector. He's talking of Russia, and he uses schemes of production to show how they interrelate. And it would exactly fit your viewpoint in that. Well, it's more than that. And Mick's colleague, William Bates, professor of economics, one of the professors of economics at Bates at LSE, has written a very long article, which was on the FT site, which, of course, has an enormous amount of detail. You can spend your entire day reading a thing. Where he tries to argue that effectively Britain is Iceland. Now, of course, if Britain is Iceland and it goes down that way, and he does think it'll happen, a collapse of a country like Britain must mean a depression. I don't think it'll actually happen myself.
No.
But if he has an argument, a very strong argument. And if anybody watched or listened to Will Hutton, he put both sides of the argument, and clearly it is balanced, and it is theoretically possible. It's more than theoretically possible. Under certain conditions, Britain could be in severe difficulty. It won't go down, because all that needs to happen is that Brown will go along and see Obama, and he'll get the loan. Even if America doesn't have the money, he'll give the money. So Britain will not go down.
It's called printing.
Yeah, they'll print the money. They are not going to allow the first capitalist, what I've said, on Susie's radio, they're not going to allow, the first industrialized capitalist country, the former imperial overlord of the lord of the world, to go right down. What a picture for capitalism.
That assumes they can do it.
Yes, they may not be able to do it. It's possible.
That assumes they have the money.
Well, they can
print money.
Yes, they destroy the currency.
Well,
yes.
It's possible.
But they have talked about this very openly.
Now. Yeah, they are talking. They're absolutely right. You're now on the question of inflation and deflation. I don't know. During a period of what amounts to depression or mass unemployment, you have forces of deflation acting very, very strongly. And that would, I think, be sufficient to contain the inflation. Whether it contains the inflation once you start to go up is another question.
Well, that's a counter-recession argument. I would agree with you. That's not where we are right now. The imbalances are so huge, they cannot be repaired simply by having the printing press. The start of the printing press wouldn't keep up. We're talking trillions. It's actually very difficult to print trillions of dollars.
You don't have to print the money.
I know, you can just do the counting. It's simply out of the dimensions.
It is an accounting measure. It's now talking about quantitative easing, so-called. Federal Reserve Bank or the Bank of England buys the government bonds. Yeah. So the government issues bonds and it buys it itself. That's basically what you're talking about.
I mean, we may have already, I mean, just to interrupt, I mean, but we may have already had a much, we could have actually gone to complete collapse after Lehman Brothers anyway. I mean, that's exactly, I mean, what happened on September the 15th and over that weekend, by the beginning of that week, that next week, just to follow up here, I mean, you know, I followed that very closely, as I'm sure many people in this room did, but it was quite clear that they looked over the edge of the collapse. And the only way they could get out of that collapse, now there's only a temporary solution, was to start printing a lot of money and effectively nationalising massive amounts of these assets. So it was a short-term solution, but that's what they were looking at.
Yes. Just to interrupt, that boosts the power cycle, no?
Sorry?
That boosts the power cycle again.
Yes. Well, yes, inevitably.
Which makes it look rather good. But, I mean,
better to have a live parasite than a dead dog, I suppose.
Well, exactly.
Who knows?
Getting into
I think that's exactly the point. Anyway, the question is whether it is not a recession. And the only other word we actually have is depression. Jack wants
to. No, we don't.
Well, repression. How about repression?
No, that's not.
No, you haven't introduced another word. You've introduced two words.
Neil Fogarty is repression.
You've got to give it all up, right?
Near depression.
No, it is near. Real. Look, the fact is that a number of official figures, like the head of IMF, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, did actually say and did think and said more than once, including on BBC here, that in the period Mick's talking about, the world faced a global meltdown. Which is
just after that,
which makes your point, of course. And the big difference between 1929 and today is the massive intervention of governments. Mm. But that doesn't alter the argument that one could then argue that it is a depression. Because if governments intervene, so what? I mean, the underlying forces are the same. It's just that the government has actually limited it. And finally, in the question of inflation, well, I don't see why you can go on printing money as long as you have deflationary pressures. What they are arguing is that as soon as you move out of that, you then hit the working class with huge levels of taxation. Well, that's perfectly possible. It isn't nice, but it's perfectly possible, I think.
Okay, so now, Paul and that's four, and then that'll take us to 2:30, I'm assuming, so...
Yeah, all three speakers have used the term collapse. I mean, Jack used it in terms of this is not a collapse, and I wasn't sure whether it was in the US economy or capitalism, whereas Hillel's referred to the collapse of the British, or Britain.
They say that
the system does not collapse, but that Iceland has collapsed. So I'd like you to clarify what you mean by collapse, because it's a term that I understood from listening to Hillel previously that Hillel was loath to actually use in terms of a collapse in capitalism because of its Stalinist connotations. I'd like you to clarify that.
Okay.
I want 2 points. First is also on collapse, and the second is on the vampire and exploding brains.
On what?
As far as collapse is concerned, I mean, economists, of course, are professionally obliged to trust that capitalism is fine. That's their profession. But I mean, if one looks at the crisis since the 1990s, the deep recession of the early 1990s, the European currency crisis of 92, 93, the peso crisis of 94, the Russian crisis, what was it, 98, the Asian crisis, 97, the collapse, they use the term, that's why I'm saying this point, of Argentina in 2001, is comparable with Iceland, might be comparable with Britain, God knows. But collapse already has happened. The economists should not be surprised that they suddenly have to teach different textbooks, as it were. Secondly, in the parasite, I mean, making money out of money is, of course, the modern form of capitalism with incest. I mean, you invest in yourself and you make a big profit. But in order for that profit not to be fictitious, it amounts, in fact, to a mortgage on future exploitation. So what's important, I suppose, about the parasite is his or her crisis-ridden relationship to the vampire, described by Marx in Capital as the one who sucks labor over the point of production for the purposes of surplus value extraction. So if one looks at the vampire, one cannot, I believe, just look at the vampire, but one has to look at the crisis-ridden relationship between a system that takes money out of money and how that relates in terms of a mortgage on future exploitation to the vampire. What happens to the vampire if the parasite coughs? And I think that is very important for our deliberation, the relationship between money and production and the crisis-ridden dissociation of money making money out of money in a way investing or speculating on future exploitation and surplus value extraction.
Hi there. I just wanted to ask a question really coming from what Hillel said quite correctly, that finance isn't a form of productive activity as far as Marx is concerned, and asked what the speakers think about the relationship over the last 30 years between finance capital and the productive economy. And what role is actually played in relationship to economy. Quite clearly, the financial crisis of the last 2 years has had a very negative effect. It's now having a very negative impact upon the productive economy. But to the extent that finance was able to derive streams of income in the forms of profit, interest or rent over the last 30 years, it must have been it must have found a resolution as far as the production of surplus value was concerned. So therefore I don't quite take Hillel's point about the turn to finance capital in the 70s being as a result of surplus capital which couldn't find opportunities to invest. There must have been a solution then as far as the productive economy was concerned. And I wonder what the speakers think those were. A secondary point, to the extent that finance capital is able to generate interest and profits from sweating labour in the real estate sector of the economy with mortgages and all of that. What is the source of that? I mean, Michael Hudson made quite an interesting point, I think, about to the extent that they're actually directly reducing the money that's gone to labour, you could argue it's not that surplus value is not the source of those interests and profits. And that he's unfortunately not here to address that point himself, but therefore his discussion of neo-feudalism is quite an interesting point, and I wonder what the other speakers make of that.
On collapse, it seems to me we can't, being aware of the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, say that collapse in the full sense of an economic system into something which is globally regressive relative to it is impossible. We can't say that. It has to be the case. It is possible that capitalism will collapse and leave behind something like the wreckage in the former Soviet Union. Yeah? It's possible. I don't think it's presently enormously likely. We have to say that that's a possible outcome of the inner dynamics of capitalism. Yeah? In that sense, I'm not willing to say Susanne Brook is totally out of the question. That's problematic. On the other hand, where we are, I'm still sceptical as to whether we're anywhere near the limits of the United States printing money. Yeah? And doing essentially the same exercise that was done in response to the 87 stock market crash, and in response to the crash in 1978, and in response to 2001. You know? Now, the consequence, of course, of that is not that there is not a crash anywhere, but that there are things like Argentina, the Russian collapse, the long depression in Japan, i.e. that the actual losses are externalized out of the United States economy, and then the externalization of the losses out of the United States economy allows the United States economy to recover as a consumer which can pull parts, not the whole lot, but parts of the rest of the capitalist centers together. And in that sense, that wouldn't be, it would be recession rather than depression. It seems to me it would be recession rather than depression. There would be depression in some places. But then the other side of it is the stuff which both Nick and Tillel have talked about, which is the relative decline of the United States. Okay, where are we in relation to, where are we in the relative decline of the United States if we map that chronology against the relative decline of Britain or the relative decline of the Netherlands? Yeah. Actually, we're not at 1914, let alone at 1938. Yeah, we're, at, as it were, talking of the decline of Britain. We're at 1862, when the British Britain lost control of the United States. In that sense, that as of 1862, there was no serious... France was the nearest thing to a serious rival to Britain, and it wasn't a serious rival. In order for there to be a serious rival to Britain, it was necessary for there to be an overthrow of the political relations within the potential rivals, which are the United States and Germany, which were preventing those countries emerging as geopolitical rivals to the United States. It seems to me that this crisis actually is likely to push precisely that this political instability. Assuming that the workers' movement doesn't intervene, then the other aspect of its being like 1862 is the extraordinary weakness of the workers' movement. We're back to not quite square one, but to a situation of extraordinary weakness. The dynamic is likely to be political convulsions which result in the emergence of potential rivals with the United States for global hegemony and into the absence of a reserve, a general reserve currency, and that sort of period of late 19th, early 20th century, the run-up to 1914, but some way off. That's just, I suppose that's points rather than questions, but I'd like people's responses.
Anybody else on this round? Go ahead. And identify yourself, please.
The Economist also this week discusses the possibility of perhaps in terms of Reykjavik on Thames, although I haven't read it yet. So certainly it flows in other parts. I would also be interested in Mick in particular, what his sort of view is of the fact that the American government allowed Lehman Brothers to collapse, and clearly was an error on their part, and what the processes were, and that if he has any insight to debate went on. In terms of the other thing, we mentioned also about Alan Greenspan. I mean, Alan Greenspan is very interesting because, if you look at this stuff, he has a ferociously free market sort of ideology from elsewhere. But of course, spends his entire time at the Fed basically bailing out the system, using state control in order to keep the whole thing afloat. And therefore, as you say, it's a tragedy for him to have to appear and say, it's terrible after he's rescued the system so many times. The interesting thing is, how much of which what he had done had actually stored up the issues which are now come to the fore, in terms of all those different collapses which have stayed off and all those issues now, it's stored up. And also to add to that, the top end of the stock market is not 2007, it's actually 2001, the dot-com collapse, and the actual move from the investment stock market and so on into derivatives and all this sort of stuff actually comes directly after that, when once you get the collapse of the dot-com boom, and that's the ending of that form of investment. And we used to see what, you know, what people's comments are on that. And obviously, the thing about derivatives, of course, is it goes into, I mean, if you talk about sort of the impact into industrial capital and society in general, it's very, very deep. I mean, you know, it's not merely, you know, derivatives are, you know, financial speculation of the banksters or whatever else. It actually involves, you know, everything from the energy market through to housing, through, you know, all sorts of basic provision, municipal bonds, the whole piece. All of these are wrapped up into that, and all of these are, you know, basic social services are a threat from just from that alone. So I'm interested to see what people think of that.
Okay. Fine. Last round. Let's keep it short. 2 minutes.
A couple comments here. You know, I really, it's obvious that this is far worse than a recession, okay? But it's also obvious this is not a depression. Mick, you mentioned 45% drop in the stock market. Well, that's what it fell in 1988. It fell 45%. That wasn't a depression. And you can look at all the other indicators. Stock market in the depression fell 90%. 90%. Prices were down 60-80%. Industrial production down 50-60%. I'm talking about the United States. Okay. All these indicators much, much worse. Now that doesn't mean that we could not eventually flow into that kind of a situation, but it is not that kind of a situation. It is not a collapse. And it's important what words we throw around. Okay. I really think it just because some panicked trader says, oh, this is a depression, doesn't mean it really is a depression. Okay. And using clever phrases and metaphors does not make it a depression either. But it's important for what strategies you develop that you have an accurate understanding what the situation really is concretely, empirically, you know, quantitatively. And there are some very clear distinctions between a recession and a depression. It can be quantitatively defined. We haven't done it. Clearly, 1930-31 was not a depression. Okay. 32-33-4 was a depression. So what's the difference between those? How did we get from one to the other? I think is extremely important. I don't use the word collapse. Collapse means you can't get up off the floor. You're passed out. You're done. Something else. But it is a crisis. Crisis means turning point. Okay, that's the meaning of crisis. And we're clearly in a crisis. We are not in a collapse. Don't underestimate the capitalists to come up with a new formula. And just because little Reykjavik has that problem doesn't mean that we're going to have Reykjavik writ large in the United States. Now, you know, I'm not trying to defend the system itself, but I am saying traditional measures don't work. Traditional, but that doesn't mean there's no measures that don't work. You know, the state can be and will be brought in new ways and new forms to prop up the system in a more significant way than it has in the past. This idea of a 20% contribution to GDP won't work anymore. That's clear. What happened in the late 70s and the early 80s was very clear. We did move towards more financial sort of depth in the economy, but other things happened too to prop up profits, and that was an attack on the working class or a whole number of measures that resulted successfully in shifting $1 trillion a year from the 110 million supervisory non-production workers to the wealthiest 1%. It did work. International capital flow limit lifting all those controls allowed capital to penetrate the third world. How do you think Asia developed? It's Western capital that developed Asia in the last 20 years. How do you think we get from $250 billion in offshore tax shelters, hedge funds, so forth, to $6 to $11 trillion in 2 decades? That money went offshore, and that money helped develop the third world to create those markets. So there's lots of ways that capital, not just financial, that capital was able to restructure itself to enable it to gain 3 or 4 more decades. But now I think that's clearly come to an end. The crisis, not collapse, is severe enough that new forms of exploitation, new forms of state involvement, they're stumbling their way towards this. They don't know. but they're stumbling their way towards this. But don't underestimate the resources and the assets of the capitalist class of the United States. I don't know, somewhere else, right? They aren't finished by any means. And I'm not ready to bet. I mean, I wish they were. Don't get me wrong. But I'm not willing to leap by the optimism of the moment that, oh, it looks like it's going to collapse, to draw certain judgments that I think could be strategically very serious if you do.
Yeah. Okay, quick, as you say, Susie. Well, I mean, if you actually look at the origins of the World Depression, it actually did take 3 to 4 years to unfold. It didn't begin, overnight. I mean, it goes back to the Austrian financial crisis of the late 1920s. You can go back to the Youngs and the Dawes plans in the 1920s. It actually took, in terms of Germany and the United States and elsewhere, it did actually take 3 to 4 years for it to unfold. So what I'm arguing is not an inevitability and an arrival at that conclusion, as I've already suggested. We are living in a different epoch, and maybe the words we use, we should find new words. But we can't simply rule out that very strong possibility. I mean, I would never have said this 2 or 3 years ago. But you simply can't rule out that possibility. We may be just the beginning of a process. And I think that's what, as I understand it, and as I talk and listen to what people tell me, who are trying in part to kind of keep this bloody situation collapsing around them. But one guy said to me the other day, a hedge fund manager, he said, I won't tell you how much money I've lost over the last, I said, well, I don't need to know that, but... He said we're a little bit like the little boy sticking fingers in this dike. We're just holding it up at the moment. And that's what I tried to say at the beginning. It's just this deep sense of their very great unease and their deep sense of insolubility to the situation they find themselves in. That's all I'm trying to reflect in my comments. I'm not trying to be overly optimistic or anything else like that, because if there's no political solution coming from the left, then it could get very, very nasty indeed. I don't underestimate the capacity of the United States, but I mean, again, what one has seen in the United States since the subprime of the late 2007 through to now just indicates a very, very, rapid, unexpected fall at all levels. And that all the measures that have thus far been taken may have slowed the process down temporarily, particularly after Lehman's. It may have propped up the system momentarily after Lehman's. But that's what they faced after Lehman's. But again, nobody's saying this is the answer. That's the point. These are kind of momentary efforts to kind of hold the wall up. If you want an image, it's a kind of series of people kind of holding it up and then sticking fingers in the dike to stop the water coming out. But none of them, as far as I can see, at all, have really got any idea as to, A, how long this is going to last, how bad it's going to get, they think it's going to become very bad, and C, what the possible answers are. That, to me, adds up, therefore, to an enormously new conjuncture historically, in historical time. On Lehman's, very quickly, whether you call it depression is another issue, but it looks to me more like that than anything else we've seen over the last 40 years. On the questions of Lehman's, I mean, I'm not a financial journalist, and most of the financial journalists didn't understand it either, especially Martin Wolf. But Lehman's was a mistake. I mean, I can't see this. I mean, somebody came to me afterwards and said, look, what they wanted to do with Lehman's was to kind of send out a message to everybody that you can go under. The moral hazard issue, as they kind of use that terminology. Yeah. I just never believed it. And again, talking to people afterwards, it's just amazing that it was a fuck up. They let it go, and as soon as they let it go, then you really move from what I would call a crisis moment to the possibility of a collapse. I mean, that September the 15th, that Black Monday, as they call it, really you could see that. And the panic that then spread, and these emergency measures they've been taking ever since. But each of these measures is exactly that, an emergency measure. They did hope, and again I'll be brief here, they were hoping that the world market economy was decoupled. That was a great hope. I spoke to a series of economists down at the LSE who were saying to me, well, okay, the US and the Europeans are going to be in deep shit for the next few years. Don't worry. There are these emerging economies, particularly China and others, who are partially decoupled, have different rhythms, different moments in the way they accumulate capital and all the rest of it. And that will, in a sense, be the solution. And they did hold on to that.
For a
But now that has completely fallen away. A colleague of mine has just come back from south from the main economic zones of China, you know, it's in southeast China, and he said, you can't believe the rapidity of industrial collapse which is now taking place within China, and the fear that this is creating both within the Chinese Communist Party and in the elite, and interestingly too, in the United States itself. And that does make the situation extremely dangerous, to come back to your point, because of the dependency of the United States on China and China's dependency on the United States. You know, if you take those two things together, then you are looking, you know, the two largest economies in the world, you know, putting Japan to one side just for the moment, one of the biggest economy in the world, and the emerging economy. If both of those are so interlocked and interdependent, but facing a huge crisis in their relationship, where you even have today, you know, key figures in this administration saying, for God's sake, how can we prop up China at a moment when they think actually China is actually in a very, very rapid downward path? That again, to me, adds up to something in the future. We simply have not worked out the consequences of what's going to happen in China over the next year. And again, I think that adds up to something pretty, pretty dramatic.
Nick, I have to ask you a quick question. Mm. So if, you know, let's say the recapitalization of the auto industry in the United States leads to GM building autos in China but not in Detroit, there's no coordinated response to this, then what's the effect?
Well, firstly, I don't think they are going to recapitalize. I mean, with this recapitalization, Chrysler will go, Ford may stay, GM may stay. I don't know. I mean, what's the point of recapitalizing an industry when there's no demand for cars around the world? I mean, what's the point of recapitalizing an industry which then, it's a bit like the Soviet Union producing things that nobody wants to buy with any, you know. I mean, this is what they're facing with Honda and the British car industry at the moment, which is not the British car industry, of course, it's somebody else's. But what they're facing is, why bother to produce cars when there's no demand for the damn things? Why bother to bring out steel when there's no demand? You can recapitalize as much as you like. But there's been a worldwide collapse in demand, which is going to be very, very difficult to kind of offset.
I got a question for you. If we have $250 billion of trade with China, if it collapses half, so we lose $125 billion, how does that compare to losing 10 million jobs and the production of over $1 trillion? I mean, China pales in comparison to what's happening in the U.S. domestic economy in terms of its impact on growth. It's not unimportant.
Well,
it's certainly important for world trade and all the other countries and the impact, but when you measure that against the massive unemployment occurring in the United States, the China trade's insignificant.
Well, I'm not sure about that at all. I mean, certainly significant. Firstly, it's very significant for China. Because China's dependency on the U.S. market is so great that any move towards protectionism in China, in the United States, or any kind of, you know, movement of currencies which went against the renminbi would create massive domestic problems for China. They know that. If you create massive domestic problems for China, you are then creating massive international problems for the global economy and for the United States. I mean, you know, as you know, I mean, one of the things which has been in part that dynamic of interdependence has been these huge Asian surpluses, these huge surpluses which China has been creating, which is then reinvested in the Chinese, in the American bond market, in the treasury market. Now, if that was to unfold, if that was to unravel, then, you know, I mean, you are then facing something really quite dramatic. And it may get back to something quite close to Asa Zavenbrück. I'm not sure we're going to get there, but I think that's a kind of dimension of it. Well, you've been wanting to stand up for 10 minutes.
No, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Yeah, go ahead. 5 minutes.
Yeah,
yeah.
No, stand up.
Makes them talk better.
Right. Begin by talking about the last discussion that Mick was bringing up and Jack was protesting about. Well, there's also a question of method. This is where I think I don't agree with you, Jack. When one looks at causation, you can do it in a kind of purely empirical way, not assigning any important moral points to one cause or another. I don't think that's a Marxist way of doing it. There's a hierarchy of causes. So when you talk, rejecting finance capital as the whole entity, as it were, and said people were compelled to work harder, there was a higher rate of extraction of surplus value. That's actually true, but I think it's due to finance capital. It's not difficult to show that. The switch of control. And when one talks about finance capital existing in industry, well, who put it there? It didn't sort of begin with industry.
it began with finance capital or industry or capitalists moving money out of industry and from there going back in. What's happened is that finance capital has dominated the economy and changed industry. That's the way way I understand it. That's why I think historically Marxists have actually looked at it. In other words, say in Britain, a country dominated by finance capital, industrial capital is compelled to conform to it. The result is it produces certain things and not other things. The result is it has to work in a particular way. The result is the profits are lower, but it has to pay the necessary profits to the finance capital, which in turn compels it to raise the rate of surplus value. In other words, the entire so-called neoliberal ideology comes from finance capital and imposes itself on the system. We're talking of, in other words, control by finance capital, which leads to all the causes that you're talking about. That's the way it does seem to me. And the same applies, I think, to your argument with Mick here. It's perfectly true. The statistics you've given are perfectly true. But we know that very small changes can have enormous impact. That's an elementary Marxist concept too. So, not that this is necessarily, what I'm going to say is necessarily the case, but you could imagine a case where a rise in prices of goods, and let's say they were sufficient from China, would tip the working class over the edge. It's perfectly possible to happen. Now, the actual change doesn't have to be very big for it. So in other words, it's not a question of global statistics. We have to look at the exact causation, the exact class, and the exact change in order to determine what will happen. And what appears to be very small can have an enormous impact. And that's the only way we can look at it. And of course, that is the way we look at it in any case, if you go through the nature of change. Change doesn't consist of huge agglomerations acting, and therefore you get even huger, as it were. Let me just turn to the question of collapse. I wasn't arguing that capitalism would collapse. I refer to the discussion around the question of whether it could happen to Britain. That's not exactly the same thing. That's not saying capitalism would collapse. And I also was saying effectively that I thought it would be bailed out, and so it won't actually happen. That's more or less, without actually saying it, what the head of the IMF was saying. An alternative to a system which isn't overthrown isn't collapse in itself, it's disintegration. Historically, I think that is what has happened. I think that's what happened to the Roman Empire. It wasn't that it simply collapsed. It disintegrated. And that's the most likely outcome over time if capitalism is an overthrown under these conditions. Disintegration of the system. And I think Mick's absolutely right to go around the world, which is what you were doing, showing these various countries which were in trouble. That's absolutely true. One you didn't mention, although you mentioned it generally, was Russia. You remember?
Yeah.
Gorbachev said, we have now entered a black hole. That's absolutely true. God knows what's going to happen to the former Soviet Union countries. Because, as you know, Russia was heavily dependent on oil and raw materials. They've gone to the floor. The system, there isn't a system there. What you've got is, I call it, is a disintegrating Stalinism. They still haven't made it to capitalism, doesn't matter how you want to put it. If you feel like the argument you call it capitalism with Russian characteristics, well, what on earth they are, God knows. But
you become a Maoist.
Yeah, well, the point is that it hasn't made it. It's been held together under authoritarian conditions. Under the conditions where they are facing an enormous economic hole, we don't know the result. There you can actually get a collapse. And of course you did have a real collapse and disintegration, where people really were going into their private plots and were surviving on it. And the system had actually collapsed. You actually had a collapse. People were living outside of history almost. That really did happen in Russia. Now that's perfectly possible there. It's possible it can happen again, and not just in Russia, but in other countries of the former Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe, where we've seen what's happening to Eastern Europe now. Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, the Baltic Republics, all in trouble, IMF going in. We don't know what is going to happen. And in other words, we are talking of it going over, changing, going down over time. I think Jack's largely concentrated on the United States, which is actually right, but I think once you start to look around the world, you begin to wonder what is going to happen. Even in South Africa, as the people burn out, no one knows what's going to happen. Who knows? It is an enormous problem, the ruling group there. So, we are talking of a major change. Of course, the terminology doesn't make any difference one level, but I think at another level it does, because it's a question of comparison, and I think Cecilia is right. The word recession is only introduced into economic language to avoid the use of the word depression. That's really what actually happened. Then the bourgeois economists define it in their own way. We don't have to adopt their definition, which is stupid in the first place. And why do we have to go into arithmetic for it? No. You don't need to go into arithmetic for it at all. You have to look at the phenomenal and underlying causation. And if you look at what was happening before March 2001, because I think what's going on now is continuation of that period, what you see is that practically all these downturns have been induced to a considerable degree by the state itself raising interest rates. That's very largely what you had after 45, rising interest rate. And at a certain point, the government or ruling class thought the working class was getting out of hand, demanding higher wages. They raised interest rates. It was always put in terms of need to control inflation. So, controlled inflation. That's the way, basically, it went. Until really 87, 88, 89. And then something began to change. What changed was the Cold War came to an end. Military expenditure went right down to 3% as opposed to 8% of GDP. Officially, of course, there was very much more more spent on arms. Just that's what was in the budget. The point is, quite clearly, it is different. The causation is different from what existed before. Because the causation is different, we have to ask whether the causation is similar. Not the figures. The figures actually make no difference. In principle, it could even be smaller in terms of its outcome. But the causation, and the causation is very similar to what happened in 1929. And Mick is right. It took 4 years for the stock exchange to go down from what it was to 10% of what it had been. Unemployment rose. In fact, it was gradual from 29 to 33. Well, what's happened here is something different. That you've had this massive asset inflation. Precisely the reason that I gave before was this huge surplus of capital, not being able to find productive outlets, and it's now deflating. Well, that deflation can go on for quite some time. The figure of the stock exchange has been mentioned. I think the stock exchange was rough. The Dow Jones was 2,087. 88, and although it went down, Jack mentioned it, the government stepped in and very quickly went up. The fact is, it went up when the government stepped in. And with roughly 2000, it reached its peak, I think about 15 months ago or so, of 14,000 something. It went up 7 times, which makes no sense whatsoever, but it went up similarly to the way house prices were going up. And that's what one has to look at, the underlying reason, which, as I say, isn't the same. It clearly is not the same as a reason why you had a downturn in the previous period, why you had a downturn in 73, 4, 5, or why you had a downturn under Reagan, which Volcker claims he was very successful in raising interest rates, and once it went down, low interest rate, and the economy came back. But in fact, well, to a degree, there's an aspect of that. On the other hand, Reagan, of course, went for the squeeze, so-called. And there was massive military expenditure, which worked. Anyway, the overall point is that we are talking of different causation at the present time. That's what's important. And it is very similar to the Great Depression, or for that matter, the depressions which occurred at the time when Marx and Engels were alive. And that is the point. Thank you.
Okay, so thank you for staying for so long. We're going to take a 30-minute break. So that means back here at 3:20 and then continue to 5 o'clock in the second session when we have a lot more discussion.